遥か遠くに浮かぶ星を思い眠りにつく君の選ぶ未来が望む道がどこへ続いていても共に生きるから ずっと昔の記憶
Hello, you're listening to Otaku Spirit Anime Cast. My name is Andrew, and I'm joined here, as always, with Chris.
Yo!
Today's episode is part one of our fall 2022 anime season first impressions. There's a lot of shows to go through, and we've decided this time that we're not going to try to do them at least almost all in one podcast because it takes so long. But we decided to break it down into three parts because there's about almost, I think there's 35 total shows. At least 35 shows that we're going to be going through. So we're going to break it down mainly because, as we kind of decided before, we it's not so much the podcast long. It's just more of the idea that we go so long that after a while, it's like you get exhausted. You start rushing through things. We want to give every show a proper shot here. So we're going to break it down into three parts, and hopefully that works well this time. The unfortunate thing that comes from that is that we have 3 weeks of doing this, and thus the third week, some of the shows are getting up there to episode five, I think. I think most of the shows that are going to be in part three will be on part or episode four. So I don't think it'll matter. But anyways, we have a lot of shows that are already hitting episode five and six, especially I'm the Villainous that started early. So yeah, as usual, we're at otakuspirit.com. It's where you can go for all of our information and links, social media links, Discord, ways that you can support us if you find the content that we provide you to be entertaining. We greatly appreciate everybody that supports us. We've gotten some new Patreon supporters, and that is absolutely fantastic. I greatly appreciate it. So without further ado, let's jump into it. We have this episode will be I Am the Villainous, so I'm Taming the Final Boss, Reincarnated as a Sword, My Master Has No Tail, My Hero Academia Season 6, Raven in the Inner Palace, Farm-Related Skills, Spy X Family Part 2. I'm sorry, Spy Family. That's a joke I'm going to keep doing. Uzaki-chan Wants to Hang Out. Was it like W or something like that? Season 2. And then Beast Tamer, Gundam, The Witch from Mercury, Management of Novus Alchemist, and Itoki the Ninja. Or Shinobi no Itoki, because I don't know why Crunchyroll doesn't want to translate that. It's like, what makes them decide what gets translated from Japanese and what doesn't? Mm-hmm. I guess if it's like conflict with some sort of IP in the West, maybe that's why they do it. Maybe there's something that's called Itoki the Ninja in the West.
I don't know.
Anyways, let's get things started. Let's start off with our first show, which I Am the Villainous, So I'm Taming the Final Boss. Or the Japanese title, Akuyaku Reijo Narode, Last Boss wo Katemimashita. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll. The studio is Maho Films. Source is light novel. Genres are comedy, fantasy, romance, supernatural. The director is the one that worked on Million Lives, which is Kumiko Hibata, and the series composition by Kenta Ihara, who did Tomodachi Game, Trapped in the Dating Sim, All Rails Lead to Doom, Tsukimichi, Miroko-chan, and Tanya the Evil. So, really good series composition writer, for sure. Not sure about the director. Maybe they just got dealt a bad card.
I'm assuming.
But yeah, this show itself, I'm the Villainous, essentially opens up with a girl named Eileen. And Eileen is, at the time that we start things out, is pretty much being told by the prince of this kingdom, I'm breaking up with you. We're gonna cut our marriage. You know, we're supposed to get married, and he's cutting it off because he has met Lilia. And what Eileen comes to a realization of is that she's actually been, at that point, she realized these dreams that she's had were of her previous life, where she was had some sort of really bad illness. She was in her deathbed. And the only thing that was she was enjoying at the time was this dating sim game. That was like her life. She really enjoyed it. But she realized that, oh, I'm now in this other world, which is that video game that I like so much. And oh, yeah, by the way, I'm the villainess in that game. I'm the nasty girl, the nasty lady that the prince eventually breaks up with because he got with the main character, which is Lilia. So that's bad for her because, similar to another show that we watched here recently, that means that she's going to be dying soon. Like, once things start going to crap, eventually the demon lord will turn into this big dragon and it will step on her. So she knows, here soon, I'm going to get stepped on by a big dragon unless I change things. So she immediately, while she's staying in this ballroom, bows to the prince, says that she's always loved him, and walks out the door. And this kind of enacts her plan. The only way that she feels at this point that she can get around this is, well, I'll go get with the demon lord. Maybe if I can get with the demon lord, maybe that will stop me from dying eventually. So she goes straight to the demon lord and pretty much proposes to him that she wants to marry him. And he immediately, like, does this big lightning attack because his emotions control the weather. And she clonks out, wakes up before him and his two henchmen. And she basically proclaims at that point, let's get married. And he's like, why? Do you love me? And she's like, no, I don't love you. It's just, it's mutually beneficial for us to do this. And this kind of turns this whole thing where she's basically hanging out with the demon lord, trying to, you know, build some sort of relationship. At the same time, she's having to deal with the fact that the prince is cutting off all of her finances, taking away all of her businesses. So she has to kind of work with the demon lord to work out some sort of business there instead, reopen a shop and get her finances right. But yeah, it all kind of leads to this point in which they're really hitting heavy on the idea that this demon lord is actually the brother of the prince. And they found at some point that he had demon blood, so they kicked him out. They created this kind of non-combat treaty between the demons and the humans. And Eileen's trying to prevent any sort of conflict between the two of them. So your thoughts on I'm the Villainess, So I'm Taming the Final Boss.
I absolutely am loving the show. I really do truly enjoy the banter between the different characters. Eileen is fantastic at kind of drawing out these characters, each one of them, between Beelzebuth, Keith, Claude. I really do love the kind of weird nature that Cedric has. Him being this kind of
jerk.
He's a jerk.
He's technically
and then
the villain.
He turned into some kind of weird, kind of obsessive stalker type at some point. I really do like how this has all played out in when all is said and done. I really am excited about what they do in the future.
So what do you say? I've jumped between two of them. Which one do you think it's more like? And there's an obvious answer here, but my next life as a villainess or the one that I'm kind of actually leaning more towards now is Life is Tough for Mobs.
Yeah, I'm going to go with that as well. It's one of those that I really do like the fact that it's not it is kind of trying to play the whole playing your cards against each other type thing, but it's not really, oh yeah, by the way, I had this planned the whole time type thing. So I really
it's
do
all
like,
according to the Princess Keikaku.
Yeah. So I have really enjoyed that. I mean, Eileen does occasionally do that here and there, but it's not really so blatant that it's like, really, I mean, come on. No, it's staying kind of generally within this kind of realm of, yeah, I can see that this character would do that. And I've really enjoyed it for that fact. And the whole, avoiding, I really do get a kick out of the whole avoiding unfortunate mishaps that are going to kill Eileen by literally taming the demon lord. So and even going into this next arc that they're doing that, and that leads me to believe, are they going to do that with another arc in the future? So it'll be interesting to see where they go from here. As it stands right now, I'm very much enjoying it.
That was kind of the expectation that I had for my next life as a villainess, All Route Leads to Doom, was this idea of going to sequels. And I wasn't really expecting something like that with I'm the Villainess, because that's the way they kind of get around. Well, if she avoids the Doom flags, how does it go into another Doom flag? So they have kind of explained how they can get into another Doom flag with her. And it's nice that it's keeping that present in the show itself, because that is the hook, initial hook is I don't want to die, so I'm going to do this thing in order to prevent it. So it is doing something in order to keep that sort of hook going. Now, it's not the focus. I don't really think it's the focus. What it kind of does, like I said, is it my initial impressions coming into is I think it's going to be my next life as a villainess. But it's not really, because she is dropped right at the point of the Doom Flag appearing, which is the prince gives up on her and goes to the lady. So it's not like my next life as a villainess where she starts out very young going, oh, I need to fix things now and prevent it in the future. It's more of a, you're in the moment now, fix it. So she's got a little bit more, she's got a rush to things very, very quickly with a scenario. And I think it's doing that very well. But like I said, I was joking about with my next, Life in Atome Games is Tough for Mobs. I feel like it's more like that in the feel of how it is this Atome game that she is in. But because of her actions, it feels like things are kind of breaking. So the normality of things doesn't seem like it is. And it is definitely pointing out the absurdities of the game itself. One key thing being is, yes, Eileen now being older, she does reflect on her entire life, which was to be this the next queen. And so her entire life was devoted to that, similar to a Atome game, where it's like Tougher Mobs, it's about this idea of you realizing at some point the villainous character in the story, that she has a reason to be mad. She's lived her entire... She had, especially with this case, Eileen had nothing. She was the youngest daughter of this family of nobles, and of course all the expectation is on the brothers. She was kind of left to the side because she was a female. And so when the prince came to her, she had purpose finally. And so there's a reason for her to be upset about that. Now, granted, I don't feel like the show really spends much time really getting into the fact that she's upset about that. She really kind of addresses it very momentarily, but it still gives you a sense of this is kind of a screwed up world. And as it goes along and as she's pushing back and as she's getting with the Demon Lord, eventually, yes, that twists the prince to the point where he's just pretty much the bad guy. He's an absolute psychopath. And he doesn't like the idea that now this thing that he said go away is now beautiful and now is seeking out his brother. And now he's jealous and now he wants everything for himself. He's just the very selfish prince. And I like how it kind of twists that kind of stuff and pushes it forward. But overall, I've been enjoying the show. I think a lot of that contributes to the seiyuu. I think it was Rie Takahashi was for Eileen. She's fantastic. I will admit, I think the only thing that I'm really struggling with the show so far is it feels like the pacing is just breakneck speed. It feels like the show was over in four episodes. It felt like the show ended. Like, you could literally watch four episodes and just be done. Like, you could just turn it off. But like I said, it is technically trying to shift into changing it to something else, which could be interesting. I haven't got quite far enough into five to know if that's going in a direction that I'm going to like. But it's definitely kind of shifting things into a different story, and I'm curious how well it's going to pull that off. It makes sense to the overall story. But I will admit that going into like episode five, it was like, oh wow, we're like this close. Like it felt like the romance just could progress very quickly. And I think that's the only thing, the only down that I can probably give the show is that the romance doesn't really feel like it makes sense. Like it's just, it goes from snap point to snap point to snap point. You don't really get the in-betweens to see that kind of progress. So that would be probably the only thing that would give it a pretty solid negative. But I think for everything else it's doing, the romance really isn't the focus. Just don't come into this expecting a really solid romance. I think it's still cute. I love the chemistry between Eileen and Claude, especially early on. It was really funny seeing the two of them. Eileen trying to get some sort of connection with Claude. Claude kind of at some points going, I kind of like this, but I don't know what to do. He's obviously a very secluded demon lord. He doesn't really know how to respond around people. And I think Eileen herself isn't really that good with romance either. So it's really kind of the two oddballs in the game coming together and realizing something between the two of them. But the core thing that I do think is decently well done between the two of them is the idea of Claude realizing how important Eileen is based on how she respects what he desires. He wants basically humans and demonkind to coexist. And she's doing everything she can. Yes, part of it is her avoiding Doom Flags, but in the other sense, she's going above and beyond to pull blame upon herself just to prevent any sort of conflict. One example they gave, I think it was in the second episode, is this Fenrir baby pup, whatever, escapes. And it goes into the human realm, or the human areas. So Eileen goes there and kind of takes the blame upon herself, not so that they can blame the demon kind, blame upon herself so that she prevents that conflict. And Claude sees that, and he does like that, because again, she's protecting what he desires the most. So like I said, they did that pretty decently well. I haven't really got a sense of Lilia yet. I think that Lilia is kind of the interesting catalyst in the entire picture, because she is, in the game, she was the main character. So she's obviously the one that gained the trust of the prince. But she's always kind of there as, she has to fulfill these duties. Like, she is the holy maiden or whatever, and she has to do this one thing, but she doesn't realize how that's destroying everything around her. And in the game, you probably would never realize that. But since it's a reality world now, and things are kind of shifting, everything she does kind of seems like it's messed up, because it's breaking what Eileen wants to do. So she kind of feels like she is a bad guy and that she's manipulative, but it hasn't really gone that direction. It just really feels like she's completely clueless as to what she's really causing conflict for. She feels she needs to take on Demon Lord. At the same time, Eileen's like, no, this doesn't really have to happen. We can avoid this aspect, because that's going to lead to tragedy. I like how it's doing that kind of stuff, so... Yeah, overall, visually, it's not incredible. I think it's doing well enough. But at the same time, I think it's been a very interesting trip. And besides the pacing and how it feels like it's kind of jumping around story-wise, that's my only real big beef. But everything else has been really enjoyable. Episode 3 was really solid, and I was very surprised by how much I enjoyed it. Episode 4, like I said, felt like the pacing picked up, and episode 5 just feels like we jumped into a completely different story. So we'll see how that one turns out, but... So far, it's turned out to be a much surprise of the season, and I wasn't really expecting much out of it, so it's a positive from me. And yeah. Any final thoughts?
No, I like I said, I really have enjoyed it so far.
Almond best bird? I really like Almond.
Almond's cool.
It got kind of dark in episode 4. I was like, wow, they're actually doing this. And then Almond comes to the rescue. I was like, yes, Almond! I literally said that out loud in episode 4. I'm like, yes, Almond, go, Almond! Things are getting really screwed up right now, and I don't know if I want this to happen. But yeah, I'm the villainess, so I'm taming the final boss. Check that out if that's interesting to you. Let's move on to some cute cat girls. We have reincarnated with a cat girl named Fran. Or I'm sorry, it's reincarnated as a sword. Tensei, Shitara, Ken, Denshita. This one is streaming on High Dive, running for 12 episodes. Unfortunately, High Dive is a week behind because there's an exclusivity in Japan, apparently. Being done by Studio C2C, the source is a light novel. The genres are action, adventure, comedy. Directing being done by Shinji Ishihara, who did Tsukimichi Moonlight Fantasy, Log Horizon, and Fairy Tale. So, yeah, this one opens up. I'm going to skip the bad stuff. It opens up with this girl named... Just joking. It opens up with a guy that's in our world. He unfortunately passes away, and he gets reincarnated into another world as a sword, as the title would lead you to believe. I know, big shocker. It's a really big, grand-looking sword. It kind of... It's almost like Zelda, when you go to that Master Sword, it's on this, like, monument and everything, you have to pull it out, it's like that, and, like, it's a huge, gorgeous-looking sword. Very special, obviously. But he's reincarnated as this sword, and he's just sitting there, and he's trying to figure out why he's there and everything, and eventually hears a voice saying something like, oh, yeah, you're gonna have a rough life, and then that was it. Not sure who that was, but...
It was the sword leaving before him.
Did we establish that?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was a sword.
Wouldn't it say that he was a sword that
he
was leaving?
No, he was a sword said that as he was leaving.
A sword said that as he was leaving?
Or it was a sword spirit. It was there. It was there. I promise.
I don't remember any of that. So a sword spirit left, apparently, according to Chris. Anyways, he then hears like the system voice lady that's kind of telling him about some attributes he has. He has this big screen that shows all of his stats and everything. Quickly realized that he has things like telekinesis, so he can move himself around. And the ability to give whatever he has to his wielder. And so he's like, oh, cool. I just need to get a wielder. I don't have a wielder. Some goblins come by. He's like, no, I don't want to be wielded by you. He kind of levitates himself and slices up the goblins, realizes that whenever he kills the gem that's within the monsters, he gains skills, and he can put those skills into skill slots. Over time, he kind of just keeps leaving this pedestal, going out, killing nearby monsters, coming back and resting, applying stats and everything. Eventually, we cup to the attention of this girl named Fran. She is of the Black Cat tribe, which is this beast tribe. Everybody looks down upon the Black Cats because they're, unlike all the other beast tribes, they don't evolve. Nobody has ever really witnessed a beast cat or a black cat evolve. So she's looked down upon, treated like crap. She's got this collar on that forces her to do servitude. They have all these other people there that are being forced to work as well. And eventually she's just kind of, you get a sense that she really puts herself before other people. If somebody's being, you know, beaten around, she'll jump out in front of them. If anybody kind of criticizes the Black Cat, she gets angry. So she has a lot of pride in her tribe. Over time, you'll learn eventually that her parents and her went on a journey because their parents were trying to evolve and they failed and died of exhaustion. And now, at this point, now traveling through this one forest, it gets attacked by this big, huge, double-headed bear thing. And as she's kind of claiming that she wants power, she eventually realizes that the sword is nearby. He planted himself in some ground that absorbs mana, so he got stuck there. So she wields him, takes out the bear, goes to put it back because she knows that they're just going to take it from her. But then he ends up killing her master and freeing her from her lock. And they both travel together, seeking to help get Fran stronger so she can achieve her dreams of evolving. While at the same time, this sword's allowed to have a wielder that's not a goblin, I guess. And they travel around. Fran's trying to get stronger. Eventually, they run into a blacksmith. Blacksmith kind of makes them some gear and then join the Venture's Guild like all ESEC guys do. And yeah, Fran's cute and adorable and must be protected. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts?
I'm actually surprised. One of the things that I, if anybody who's listened for a while, you remember, I was a little bit concerned about the whole idea of these inanimate objects as the reincarnations.
Like a vending machine?
Yeah, the vending machine in this one in particular. I was a little bit concerned about that, but I was actually surprised how well this has been incorporated into the story. I mean, I would kind of have figured the whole telekinesis thing, and I was, like I said, I was a little concerned about it, but I'm actually surprised how well they've done with it. It works out well that there is this kind of aspect of him gathering the skills and then transferring them, and yet not at the same time not really kind of making her too overpowered. So I'm actually really impressed with how they've handled a lot of that. The story overall has been a little bit slow. I'm fine with Fran. Fran, like Andrew said, is adorable, and I really truly love the way that she's kind of,
they've kind of turned them into a father-daughter kind of scenario. Like, yeah. he's like, man, she's gonna get cute at some point and people are gonna be all over her. I won't allow it. I will protect her.
So it's actually worked out really well. I've enjoyed the interaction between Shisho and Fran, and a lot of these other characters as they've kind of come in and how they are adding to the story. They're not, but it's still overall, the story has felt kind of slow. But that's pretty much where I'm at. I mean, it's one of those that I'm just enjoying it right now.
I think a good description somebody gave of Fran was Renge. I can see Renge. Like, she does every now and then have that kind of very, very almost dunce look to her when she realizes something bad's happening. Like, she's like, we're gonna burn it all up, and he's like, yeah, we're gonna burn it all up, and she's like, no, we're literally burning up the forest. He's like, oh no, pour it out. It's a lot of fun. So my thoughts. First episode sucked. Now, the very end of it was really good, and I know I got a lot of criticisms of that. Some people claim that I don't like world building because I don't like him running around gaining skills for what felt like 15 minutes. No. World building's fine. Skill gaining, I'm tired of. I've been through too many shows at this point that do that, and I hate it every time. So I'm a spider, so what? Reincarnate as a slime. I don't like these shows that spend most all of an entire episode having them go around slicing things, gain skill. Slice thing, gain skill. I would have better liked just a montage and just bam, 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 it's all there. That aside, that first 15 minutes of the first episode, that aside, I really enjoyed that episode because I really enjoyed, obviously, being very heartbroken about what's happened to Fran, quickly liking her because of how selfless she is. And yes, seeing the fact that she's so pushed down and that she has this obvious pride for her family bloodline. And to have that moment where it all kind of comes to a really nice payoff at the end was welcomed. Obviously, he's gained all these things. That transfers to her. She suddenly becomes super overpowered and just wrecks things. And it was some great animation, too. Like, seeing her... So far, I think, overall, like, at least the first and second episodes, third episode is... It's still good. Overall, like, the animation for the combat sequences have been really good. Like, the fight with the guy at the Adventure Guild was great. And again, the fighting the bear was great because it had this whole thing of her going over him and sliding underneath him and slicing him and stuff. It was really cool looking. That was a good payoff at the end of the first episode, despite the fact that I didn't like the beginning of it. Going to the second and third episode, I think, is where we're getting into the chemistry and what we're kind of expecting for the entirety of the show, which has been really solid. It's a lot of the case of, again, Fran wielding him, really cherishing what she calls Shisho, the sword. She really cherishes Shisho. This is the thing that has protected her. It's giving her the strength that she needs in order to get better. And now we're finally seeing that she is herself, not just the sword, herself is now getting stronger. She's now leveling up. She's basically power leveling at this point. But you're kind of seeing that. And yeah, I kind of agree with Chris. It doesn't really go to the extent that she is completely invincible. She still has, you know, stamina. She still kind of works herself to death. She still gets these points where she gets ahead of herself, and she's realizing that she can't just kind of jump into every situation and swing the sword and it's all done. I don't know how well they're going to play that off going forward, but it seems like they're now kind of addressing that aspect. She's not completely overpowered. She does have limits. Other than that, it's been really good. I just absolutely adore Fran. Her getting her adventure car and looking all happy. Mm-hmm. A lot of the conversations between the two of them was great, especially early on, because he couldn't get a read on her. Like, again, she's basically spent most of her life working under forced servitude, and so she's got a little bit of a sense of not really having a lot of emotion. So whenever he's like, oh, I can actually talk to you through telepathy through your head, and she's like, oh, he's like, you're excited, and she's like, yeah, I'm excited. Like, I don't see that. A lot of that stuff was really good, but yeah, I really do like the chemistry so far. And like I said, Fran is just absolutely adorable. And I like that they're positioning it in a way that it really does feel, like I said earlier, kind of a father-daughter kind of thing, because obviously anybody that's watching the show is just, you want to protect her smile. You want her to be happy. And they're kind of playing that out pretty well so far. As to what it can kind of turn into going forward, I don't really know at this point. Like I said, the main goal focus for both of them right now is just that Fran wants to become an evolved. I don't know. I'd assume that that's probably not going to be anytime soon. I'm assuming that that's kind of changed her character design, so it's probably something way down the road. But it does seem like that's the main focus, and everything else around them is kind of just secondary. Okay, well, I think another thing they're kind of trying to hit on so far with the second and third episodes, it does feel like they're also trying to change the perspective of the Black Cats to everybody. Because very early on, I kind of am a little bit upset about this. Very early on, it felt like everybody hated Black Cats. So the moment that she walked, obviously she's being mistreated when she's being forced to work. When she gets to the town, everybody's saying that she stinks and looking at her with disgust. She goes into the Adventure Guild, and it feels like there's this one little band of people that are talking about how, oh yeah, on the battlefield, we used to burn Black Cats to death. I mean, they're useless. They're these stains on society. And it really felt like she was very angered by that. And it felt like, I guess through her actions, people around her started to kind of accept her more. But it feels like beyond that, it just doesn't seem like anybody's kind of addressing that anymore. So I don't know if that's going to be a talking point, but I would assume that, you know, her actions, her status as a hero protecting the village and stuff might change people's perspective. She might change the perspective of her clan upon everybody else, which I think would be pretty cool too. So we'll see where that goes. For now, it's just adorable. Adorable friend. That's pretty much my main reason for watching the show. And the action scenes are pretty solid. I do like how they're playing out a lot of the action scenes, too. Like I said, with the first one, it's a lot of, like, her utilizing her size compared to the bear, jumping around him, sliding underneath him. A lot with it. And then they have the cases, like, with the goblins. It really does feel like she's utilizing different strategies, such as, you know, using rock cannons and jumping around and utilizing her speed and everything. So it does seem like it's trying to at least be very unique and clever with a lot of the combat sequences. I'm not sure if that's something that'll evolve going forward to as well, but we'll see. But so far, it's been a solid watch. I've been enjoying it. Again, I'm a little sad that they're behind a week, but I think once I got my first impressions done, I was like, okay, I'll wait for High Dive. I hate the idea of it, but I'll wait for High Dive. So High Dive, come on. Come on. Anyways, that's Reincarnated as a Sword. Check that out if that's interesting to you. And if you enjoy cute cats. If you don't, then shame on you. I don't want to talk to you. My Master Has No Tail is the next one. Or Uchi no Shisho wa Shippo ga Nai. This one is also streaming in the High Dive, running for 13 episodes, done by Leiden Films. The source is a manga, genres are fantasy, comedy, supernatural. Directed by Hideo Yamamoto, who did Strike the Blood and Spec Ops: Asuka. Series composition by Toko Machida, who's done a lot of incredible works. We really enjoy her stuff. And yeah, this one takes place in the Taisho era between 1912 and 1926. And we follow a tanuki. And this tanuki, you get a real quick sense that her father really loved going into the towns where the humans were. And comes back all the time talking about how much she enjoys being around the humans, playing tricks on them and everything. And so this really kind of instills upon this tanuki Mamida that she really wants to do the same thing her father does. Unfortunately, her father, I don't think they really imply, but they basically said that he passed away and haven't really revealed exactly how. I'm assuming that Bunko, who she eventually runs into, knew who he was. But yeah, she really badly wants to go there, just like her father did. And so the chief finally reluctantly says, okay, you could do it, but come right back. Don't play tricks on the humans. They don't work no more. Society has kind of advanced to the point now where the humans don't really, their tricks don't work anymore. So tanukis, when they go there, they don't do their usual tricks, which obviously tanukis like to do their tricks. So yeah, eventually Mamida does go to the humans area, runs around, tries to play tricks on everybody. Nobody really goes with it. Most people find her out and chase her down. The big fear, obviously, is that she'll eventually end up in a hot pot. But eventually she tries to trick this one lady, Nambunko, who's on this bridge. And so she transforms into what her father looked like, approaches Bunko. Immediately, Bunko says, I know what you're doing. Go away. Leave this town now. Seen right through her disguise. Again, that's where I'm kind of assuming that there's a possibility that she knew. Either she knew that she was a tanuki, or she knew her Mamida's father, probably. But anyways, she leaves. Mamida immediately is like, oh, wait, who are you? And she's like, I'm just a rakugo performer. And she walks away. Well, she eventually comes across this one theater, goes inside. Everybody's kind of surrounding it, so she's kind of interested in what's going on in this theater. And she sees a performance by Bunko doing a rakugo performance. And immediately, Mamida is swept up in the story. And so she kind of feels like this is a great way for me. She tricked me, basically. Bunko tricked Mamida. And so she really badly wants to learn rakugo so she can trick people as well. And so she keeps trying to push Bunko over and over again. Let me be your, you know, your kohai. Teach me how to be a rakugo performer. I really want to do this. Bunko keeps, you know, saying no, 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 and eventually kind of accepts it. And so going into the further episodes, it really gets a sense of Mamida having to understand what all is involved in the rakugo performance. It's not just the actual rakugo performer. Getting a respect for that kind of stuff, and then eventually trying to learn how to perform rakugo, and then getting wrapped up in one of the performers, Shirara, and her family issues, which is kind of an interesting side tangent. But yeah, your thoughts on My Master Has No Tail?
I really do enjoy the show. It's taken its time to set up each one of these characters, and I do enjoy that. I love the idea of, at least the way it seems to me is that, Bunko is kind of this, either a kitsune or something like that to kind of play off of the, idea of a second kind of trickster, being, for lack of a better term, and, Mamida wanting to kind of, learn from her. And I think that they've played that pretty well. This idea of changing the way that they're doing things. Like Andrew said, humans don't get tricked anymore. And I think that that is something that is very important to consider in this show, is the idea of the old world being left behind and the new world coming in. And how can these spiritual beings kind of adapt to that change?
It was really cute because, like, in the first episode, what they kind of have is Mamida is fleeing from all these people that she tricked, and she jumps off of this tower thinking that she could do this tanuki move where they make their sack really big.
Yeah, right.
And she realized, oh, wait, I'm a girl. I can't do that. But Bunko saves her. And it was a really cool scene because it has this point in which Bunko says, I felt the same way. Mankind has advanced to the point where, again, we can't really trick them anymore. But we obviously can't get over that desire. We still want to do that.
And humans honestly, still want to,
yes,
deeply.
It cuts over to these humans that are on the tower where she just jumped from, and they're all like, she got us. Like, she tricked us. She somehow got away. And she hits on that. Like, humans still, deep inside somewhere, still desire to be tricked. And that's why you get a sense that that's why she does rakugo performance. She desires to do that.
And that's one of those cool things about how the entire thing with entertainment which is basically what Rakugo is a form of entertainment, is still something that humans desire. And we still want the idea of
a fantasy.
Yeah, fantasy.
I mean, that's what they kind of hit with the whole thing with Shirara, is this like very tough, like Yakuza-esque guy that takes her away, and Bunko, you know, performs a Rakugo for him. And it's kind of that sense of he gets tricked into what she was telling that somehow managed to reflect on himself. And so it throws him off. He's like, wait, what'd you do? Like, he realized at some point she gave him a fantasy and an image of something, and he started going with it. And he started reflecting on himself about it. He was able to relate to the story that's being told, and that tricked him, made him do something he wasn't expecting. And I think that's kind of plays into it, despite the fact that he is pretty much the definition of not all adults, but he feels like he's mature, he's strong, he's not going to deal with trivial things. No, he kind of wanted it. And that's kind of what she's showing him.
Yeah. And when it comes down to it, that's why I kind of really want to keep continuing watching, is this, the idea of this kind of interplay of how these stories are actually playing out and how they actually fit into this idea of Mamada becoming something more than what she was before. A trickster tanuki turning into this master Rakugo entertainer, and how she can change the way she does things to reflect the newer age, per se.
She found her unique thing, though.
Yeah.
The drum beat thing. Yeah, I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. I would be interesting if they actually play off of that. It seems like they are, but no.
But yeah, all in all, I'm enjoying myself watching the show, and I'm more than happy to let it play out the way it wants to play out, because this is a lot a more slower paced. I mean, if you turn on one, it half the time it feels very chaotic. But I think that the story itself is playing out slowly, while you have this entertainment of Mommy Dad learning all kinds of goofy stuff.
Yeah, I think that's to get my negative out of the way for this show. It obviously, coming into this, I'm going, okay, it's eccentric family show again, Roku Shinju. So I think they pretty much covered the whole eccentric family aspect of it with the fool's blood and Mamada and the hot pots, and her pretty much nearly getting herself taken out because of her. Just, she has this great drive. She must do something foolish. She must trick people. She can't get over it. And I think they're pulling off really, really well. The other side of it, which is, again, was the Shogun Roku part of it. Yes, it's Rakugo, but it's not Shogun Roku Rakugo Shinju. And that's fine. I'm just saying, that was my hope, was that they would at least instill upon the viewer that same feel of the performances themselves. Why I feel like they fail with what Showa did, Shogun Roku Rakugo Shinju, is that they don't let you get lost in the performance. Instead, they show the character is getting lost in the performance. For those that have never watched Shogun Roku Rakugo Shinju, please go watch it. It's literally one of my favorite anime of all time. It is essentially about Rakugo performers, and the main key thing they do there is they just perform. You just hear the person speak it. You get different camera angles of them on the stage. You get a lot of sense of their body motion, their body language, sweat going down their side of their face. You just see the performer. And I got lost in the stories just by their voicing, just by how they portrayed his performance on the stage. This show, really quickly, you hear the first few dialogue lines, and then suddenly you're seeing characters in the story. And I think that's kind of a letdown for me personally, because I wanted to get lost just like that other show. Not a bad thing, just kind of a letdown. So that aside, that's my only real negative, is that I kind of wanted to be lost by the performers. And I think Bunko, the person that's the save for Bunko, I think she's doing a great job of it. She's able to perform that stuff very well. I like a lot of the other stuff they're doing as well. Like Shirara, she goes on stage and she's kind of seems like she's an opener. She goes up there and she really gets people's attention because she makes a lot of clapping noises. She tells people about the performance itself, the knee guard thing they have there, the different instruments they use, the clacker, the fan. She's explaining it while getting people's attention, and she's a lot of fun. And I like that aspect as well. And I'm really curious to see how they pull off this other performer that's apparently going to come in later, who is, yes, the voice of Kiku from Shogun Roku Rakugo Shinju. I can't wait to see what they do with him. But again, I will say I'm let down by the performances themselves, and not allowing me to get lost in their voice, but rather showing me what I should be seeing.
What's kind of neat, though, to kind of compound on what Andrew's saying is where this kind of shines that as opposed to Shogun Roku is showing the kind of background, showing how how the things in the background kind of work. Like Andrew was mentioning, the Shirara being this kind of opener act, or talking about the players in the background playing.
Which they technically did have present in Showa.
Yeah,
I agree. This one's really going like it feels like it's trying to tell you. Like it's obviously introducing Mamada to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that they're trying to go through and show. Like I said, literally was episode 3 or 4 was Mamada. You need to understand it's not just Bunko. It is all these people. It's the manager. It's the person that does the folding of the kimonos. And this person, the player of the musical instruments, it's the drummers, all that kind of stuff is a crucial role to create that performance. And it definitely hits on the idea that she's talking about this different stuff. And then suddenly, oh, she's in the red light district. And then suddenly you hear the drums going off and you hear the person strumming the I forget what's the name of the, it's not a guitar. It's just like a,
I was thinking, trying to remember it too.
Banjo, a very tall banjo or whatever. But yeah, anyways, like I said, it's not a bad thing. It's just, it's definitely wasn't really the flavor I was looking for, which is fine. Cause I think, I don't know, I almost get a sense like this is going to be something similar to something like Hanasaki Aroha with Eccentric Family. Like, I'm going away from Shogun Rakushinju. Just a Rakugo performing theater of Hanasaki Aroha with the performances of the Rakugo kind of mixed in there with the fullnessness of the Tanuki, which I think it's, with that ingredient panel in place, I'm really enjoying it. That's not me saying this is Hanasaki Roha. That's not me saying this is Shogun Rakushinju. It's not Centric Family. It's just those are kind of the flavors I'm getting. So if you're looking for those kind of things, you're going to get a kind of a similar flavor here. But it's been great so far. I've been enjoying it. I will say that it's not as fantastic as I was hoping it to be. I do think that when I came into the show, I was expecting something really grand. And I think similar to what Chris is saying, the slowness of it, I think, is playing into that element of, okay, settle down, just kind of enjoy it kind of thing. And it's not doing anything super incredible so far. But I do like the chemistry it's setting up. I like that they're really hitting heavy on her having to learn a dialect. Like, she has to learn a Sokka dialect because otherwise it's not going to really hit. Like, the jokes and the way that everything kind of plays out, it's not going to hit. It's kind of an interesting inside look into the language itself and how it plays out. So her big struggle right now is just learning that dialect so she can rhythm it, so she can get that pacing going for the performance itself. And it'll be curious to see how she figures it out. Again, she technically has learned her unique thing, which is the Tanuki's ability to really kind of entrance people with a beat, which I thought was when that happened, I got a huge kick out of it. She's just having so much fun. And I think that's the thing that I'm really enjoying the most is really kind of seeing how they can make a lot of fun out of it. Again, a lot of the performances of Shirara, which is technically like 2 opening sequences, her stuff, which is really fun. And then, like, again, Mamada entrancing all these, like, semi-Yakuza people into this drum beat was just super cute and super fun. So it definitely has its moments. Like, it pulls off its moments really well. And I think so far what they've kind of portrayed with the importance of the people around you to the performance itself, again, a lot to do with, like, Mamada and her kind of more pure but foolish nature. That stuff has really been a lot of enjoyment for me for this show, and I'm looking forward to more of it. I'm kind of, I like how in the mid-cards they do it a lot, too, but do you see how, like, significantly different the manga art is to the show's art?
No, I didn't.
You can see it with Mamada right here. That's the manga art. But they're, like, much wider eyes. But, yeah, it's a lot of fun. And, Omatsu is super Yuri. Umatsu's super thirsty. But yeah, I'm looking forward to more of it. But yeah, Master Has No Tail. Check that out if that's interesting to you. My Hero Academia, season 6. 6 seasons now. Like on episode, 117, I think, at this point. We've been going a long time. I'm not going to get super detailed here because I don't want to get into like any kind of spoilers for people that have not watched the series as a whole. But I will just kind of generally go over my thoughts on this particular segment so far. The soft spoilers we have here, obviously, is that we have the villains. This big organization of the villains themselves is kind of rising up. The Liberation Army itself, which is trying to essentially destroy the foundations of what society has built around quirks. From the very beginning, season 1, you get established this idea that there are Quirks appeared, and it was a lot of chaos, so they had to sort of create a system. Quirks being superpowers, basically. The system is they wanted heroes that were people that had these abilities that would essentially keep order. And anybody that was using these quirks, you know, for nefarious deeds without their permission, they would be taken down as the villains. And now we're pretty much at the point now where this organization of villains is trying to rise up, and they're even employing a lot of heroes as well to take down the system so they can go back to a point where order was by quirk. If you had a great quirk, you can have control. It basically complete anarchy. So that's pretty much where we're at right now, is they've located the facility. They're trying to go take them down, and all hell's breaking loose. It really does feel like this is like the final arc. I think it is. If I remember correctly, I think people have said it's pretty much like this is like the climax is building up to this point. But it does feel like it, because all hell is breaking loose. There were bad things are happening to certain characters. It's getting a lot more emotional. It's pretty much at the point now. I think the villain arc really established this. It really feels like most of My Hero Academia has always been kind of heroes don't take down people. They're the good guys, you know, let the police handle, you know, judge and jury and all that kind of stuff. The heroes only take down the villains and capture them. And now it just really feels like right now, there really is no way of stopping one side or the other. It's do or die situation. And I think that the way that they're kind of shifting that kind of happened in the villain arc, where we had the build up to this big liberation army that's trying to take down the system. And I think it was about that point that I was starting to regain my interest. Honestly, for, I don't know, about three seasons now, I've been losing interest in this series. And I think it's because it just kind of got stuck in a point where nothing really interesting was happening. It was just a lot about Deku having this ability to, that is technically evolving. And that was pretty much the only interest I had. I was kind of interested in what was happening with Endeavor. I like the idea of him having to fill in some shoes that are really too big for him, that he feels like he can't really fill, his insecurities around that, his family issues. I wanted to say his family endeavors, his family issues. A lot of that stuff was good. And like I said, it was really around the villain arc, late villain arc, that I started getting reinterested in the series, because it really was feeling like things were getting, I guess, a lot more mature. Like things were getting really kind of grim. And now going into this sixth season, I really just feel like things are coming to a head. And I really don't know what's going to happen with characters going forward. And I think they're pulling off a lot of that stuff really well so far. Seeing a lot of people in action that we haven't seen before, a lot of the top five in action, which is really great. And hopefully it comes to something really cool in the end. But we'll see. It's regaining my interest. So that, I think that's the main key thing that I wanted to say here with my first impressions of season six, is really that I've fallen off of it for a long time. My hype levels has really died for this series. And it really feels like it's not at hype levels yet, but I am starting to get interested to see. I'm driven to check out the show every week, which I think for a while there was like, whenever I get around to it. Like, I'm not even that, like, I gotta see what's going on next. I'm getting back to that point where I'm like, okay, next episode's up. I gotta see what's gonna happen next. So that's a good thing. So definitely looking forward to more. And yeah, Bunny Girl power. Mirko was amazing. I love seeing Mirko in action. She was good. She's, I think, fifth, top five. So, yeah. We'll see. We'll see if Chris gets back into it, too. I don't know.
It's the plan.
Eventually. It's a shonen. You have to watch it, Chris. Otherwise, everybody's...
Right. Well,
in the future, it's always going to ask, have you ever watched this? You have to watch all the big shonens. That's a requirement for what we do.
Well, I was very much enjoying it. I mean, the only reason I even stopped was because of that stupid Endeavor, everything being all goofy.
Yeah, the movie versus the season. Yeah. That was rough. And that was pretty much the point where it was really dying for me, too.
And now at this point, it's like, okay, for me to get back into it, I have to catch up on literally a season and a movie. And it's like... And then I'm still going to have to catch up on all the stuff that's out right now.
So that's what, 29 episodes and like two movies, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one movie was kind of not really necessary, but I don't know. It does cover one aspect. So actually, I think it's about three movies. I think there's been three movies. I don't know. I've lost track at this point. Raven of the Inner Palace, or Kyoku no Karasu. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll, running for 13 episodes, done by Bandai Namco Pictures. Source is a novel. The genres are fantasy, mystery, drama. And the director on this one is Chizuru Miyawaki, who did Gintama. So, great person there. But yeah, this one opens up in pretty much the setting where we have this palace, and you have the Empress Dowager, I think is what the title they give her. Essentially is an empress that took all the property and everything from the king or the emperor when they, you know, passed away or whatever. It's not really like she's appointed. But and in this palace itself, there is many consorts, but there is one consort that's kind of out of the normal, which is the Raven consort. This is a consort that is kind of secluded. The emperor doesn't visit them at all. They're just kind of off the side. Nobody sees her. She's kind of isolated. And there's this known thing that she possibly has magical abilities. Well, at some point, this one prince shows up, takes over the throne from the Dowager, and takes over the throne as the emperor, reclaiming his position, because at some point his mother was killed and he was just kind of tossed to the side. So he kind of gained the support of everybody, came in there, kicked her off the throne, and took over things. Put her in confinement till he could possibly figure out some sort of evidence that she was the responsibility, or she was responsible for his mother being murdered. So at some point, this new emperor decides to visit this Raven consort, Chizetsu, and comes to her basically asking about this earring and if it was possibly possessed, and it gets into this whole kind of mystery surrounding this earring, some lady-in-waiting, and what kind of happened with these people around the place, ultimately getting into what exactly happened with his mother. So it kind of ties the two of them together. Obviously, this Raven consort doesn't like the idea that he keeps visiting her. He keeps kind of bringing her different gifts and foods and stuff like that, and asking her questions and having her kind of consulting her on different issues she's facing. Over time, she meets other people who then kind of gets into other mysteries surrounding that. It kind of is turning into almost like a mystery per episode. Some person comes to her with an issue that's typically going to involve people that have passed away, or ghosts and spirits around them, and having her have to solve the mystery. All the while, these mysteries typically will kind of shape the story that surrounds the characters themselves, really drawing in different characters, the emperor himself, the past lineage and whatnot of this kingdom itself. So, your thoughts on, oh yeah, and technically getting into the Raven consort and her history and how she eventually ended up in the position that she is, which is another aspect. So, your thoughts?
I wasn't sure I was going to like this. Coming into this show right away, it felt, I don't know, just so bland. And very quickly, I mean, within the first half episode,
and then Jizetsu popped up on the screen.
Right? Exactly.
Jizetsu is like gorgeous.
She is.
Absolutely gorgeous. I love her character too.
It's one of those things that I am absolutely blown away how much I enjoyed the show. I really, really, something about this show, I mean, make fun of it, really was this kind of, okay, emperor comes in slaughtering pretty much everybody. I mean, he wasn't really slaughtering, but it was, that's the way it came off of this kind of uprising. And then it was a coup. And so I was like, oh God, here we go. Some kind of period piece. And I'm not going to like this. And everybody's going to tell me how horrible.
Bunch of V-chan people.
Yeah, exactly. And
bunch
then,
of pretty boys.
And then,
everybody around the emperor looks so hot. How can you not like this? Everybody's so gorgeous. I'm joking.
Make the joke about when Jujutsu showed up, I suddenly
Bam,
like
Chris
it.
Okay. Loves the show.
Yeah, exactly. but really what happened was him going to her for this kind of consultation and opening up this idea of this kind of supernatural mystery aspect of it. And really in a lot of ways that's the kind of crux of what makes the show work. This idea of her, as much as she can't stand the emperor, she's a tsundere, you know she is, but she absolutely works in this idea of the Raven consort and the emperor. They bring
like,
up the
why
idea
do you keep
of
coming
the,
by. Well, lock your door. It's like, you know, you want people to visit,
and that's a lot of it. This idea of he actually is making her life kind of open up, and she was really this kind of her her entire life was around this idea of her being secluded and not really interacting with people. But when he came in, she even points this out. Everything, she's going through all of this because he came to visit her.
Yeah, and more people visiting. It's all your fault.
Exactly.
You came here. That's why this other princess decided to show up.
And I really do love the fact that all of this aspect of how things have really kind of, her being the sheltered character, suddenly her life is kind of lively, and how she's bringing in more characters are being brought into her life. I really like how that's all playing out. From Juju and when we got into the Skylark Princess and all of that stuff, and how they kind of play off this aspect of this character was actually doing something for another character when she met her end. And I really like how all these really just simple mysteries, they're not overly deep, but at the same time, they're just solid character moments from moment to moment. And I really have liked that. And it's playing out like the way some of these, the other shows that have done this, Natsumi's Book of Friends, or Mononoke, and these go and solve the problem of this character, whatever that character is, and there's this supernatural aspect to it. And I think that's really played out well throughout this show, and I really am excited to see what's in the future as they get into probably even more deeper stories going along.
That's an interesting comparison. It has a little bit of it's not the feel of like Natsumi's Book of Friends, but like that feeling of like yokai mystery that somehow ties into somebody's relationship with somebody or somebody they've lost. That's definitely kind of a beat that's in there. Like I said, it almost turns into like a mystery per episode, but it's never kind of the focus itself. It's just sort of the vehicle in which a lot of the other stuff, such as character developments, and how the characters kind of progress and change their mood. And again, the overall story centering around Jujutsu's past and the Emperor and what he's kind of going through is really kind of delved into. And I think so far they're pulling a lot of that stuff out really well. And it doesn't feel like it's too forced. But it really does, I guess, add to what Jujutsu is and what her capability is. Obviously, being the Raven Consort, she's more magical. She's able to do a lot of things with spirits and yokais and stuff like that that ultimately affect people, because it's not a grand pretty picture. What they're kind of going through is a lot of people are going through suffrage. There's a lot of cutthroatness within the palace itself. There's a lot of murders that are happening. At some point, they kind of mention this idea that, like, this one lady in waiting, they found her hanged, and the whole issue that was behind that was that somebody pinned it on her, and through her grieving, she ended her own self. And why that's important really to the overall story is that, well, if a queen or somebody does something, or an empress does something terrible, they're obviously going to blame it on their lady-in-waiting. It just happens. Like, it's so funny that you have a lot of these ladies-in-waiting, they're all just kind of like shrug. Like, this is a thing that happens here. It's nothing you can do about it. You're not going to go to the emperor and say, no, the Empress is lying. You're going to die instantly. It's like, this is just a reality within this world. And I do agree, like, a lot of the stories are kind of really well done in the idea that, similar to something like a Natsumi's Book of Friend, it does have those interweaving stories that really do have, like, a punchline to the end of them. Like, this recent one with Skylark. It was almost like it felt like it wasn't that great. And then, like, at the very end, it has, like, this really cool tie-in with what's been happening between Jujutsu and the Emperor the entire time. Like, this whole carving of this bird ends up coming to a cool punchline at the end. But additionally, that bird he carved has a tie-in with somebody that was very important to the Emperor himself, and that ties into his story. And that's the main key thing that I want to get into, talking about one of the main reasons why I love Raven the Inner Palace so much. The writer is so good at interweaving these stories. Nothing feels kind of like a waste. Everything almost plays into a key reason or key point to one of these characters' life.
The Andrew had brought up the consort that had effectively hung herself, and that was what he was talking about, was the fact that there was another character who was poisoned, and that just so happened to be the Empress's mother and how that all ties into his backstory. And to compound on what Andrew is saying, I that is one of the things that is really well done, is this kind of the main characters are interacting with these mysteries, but when it comes down to it, they're each revealing a small tidbit of their story. While not having their story in the forefront, they're in the background getting the bricks laid for what you would assume at some point is this ultimate the consort that has not really been handled yet, is the one that's been pulling these strings for the longest time, the Daraga or whatever her name is, the one that is confined at this moment, because he wants to put justice.
Oh, the Dowager's gone.
No, she's still confined.
She's gone. He found the evidence that he needed.
I didn't see that part. But
okay. She cursed him right when he went to behead her. But
no, that was the one that was involved with that at that time. Okay.
I thought the same thing, but then he literally got the evidence that he needed that tied to her. But yeah, I guess it could have been somebody else.
The interesting thing is that all of this is all these bricks are being laid for an ultimate climax at some point that I'm sure we're going to get to when they actually do dig into the reason why the Raven consort and the Emperor are oil and water and they cannot mix. I love how all of this is playing out.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's pretty obvious at this point, but that was one of the things that I enjoyed the most, was that, yeah, they were the whole point behind her not ever conversing with the Emperor has always been the idea of what her history is and what that could technically mean, which they're, yes, right now really heavily hitting on with, it seems like, at least with the last story they kind of got into, was, yeah, the two of you can't really coexist. Like, there is a reason why the two of you should not coexist. It is basically the oil and water. It makes perfect sense that one thing can't exist with the other one existing. And I can already draw, it's pretty easy right now for me to already draw my conclusions. I'm not going to really get into much in that, but I think it is going to ultimately build into something that's really going to be incredible. Because the second thing that I'm going to get into, the first thing being, again, how good they are at writing these stories and how well it all kind of interweaves to crucial points in these characters' lives, is the character's chemistry itself that is slowly advancing over time. Yes, early on, it's super cute. Just this very, don't bother me, get out of here, pouty faces, you know, him bringing in steam buns and her, you know, pushing back her soon-deadiness because she really wants them, and that kind of stuff is super cute. But at the same time, having these really strong beats within the story, like the fact that at some point he does, you know, request her to become one of his consorts, and she doesn't really want to accept that because her master, basically the previous Raven consort, pounded in her head, don't get involved with people. Don't get involved with people. It's only going to lead to hardships because, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, yes, the oil and water aspect, but also additionally because any kind of involvement, usually what she does is usually involved with sort of spirits and yokai and stuff. So to get involved with anybody that she's working for is going to get involved with the hardships that they're facing due to loss or, you know, unrequited loves, you know, loves that never happened, hardships, heartbreak, all that kind of stuff that's going to be kind of affecting her. But she's slowly learning that kind of stuff. So having somebody so isolated for so long and having to learn to trust people around her, especially with the secret about her past, is, I think, what kind of ultimately is building a lot of these really strong relationships through trust itself. Like, Juju herself has been absolutely fantastic around. Like, put aside the Emperor himself, Juju and her relationship with Jusetsu has been really cute, and I love that kind of bond they're creating. But again, that trust with the Emperor himself and what he wants to do with Jusetsu has really, really been really phenomenal as well. And her learning to trust him and all the things that he sort of entrusted to her, which he wouldn't normally trust with her, kind of shows that element of the bonds they're creating, which has been really fantastic. It's got solid chemistry. It's got great character building. And again, it's all interwoven with some really great storytelling around these mysteries that ultimately tie their lives together. So I think it was something that I kind of noticed with the end of the first episode or the second episode. And it's something that I'm glad going into the further episodes has been kind of a solid beat, is just this writer is so good. And it visually, I have like a little bit of hesitation with the character designs themselves. I think a lot of the male characters kind of look very samey, but I think overall, like, it's got a really interesting art style to it, very much a period piece, and they're pulling off the aesthetic of that time period very well. And yes, Jusetsu slash Raven consort looks absolutely gorgeous, and they know how to make her look gorgeous. And it's really crazy because she has like all this crazy traditional stuff, like all these hairpins and stuff in her, and they're managing to animate that stuff and keep it on model. So they're putting a lot of effort into her. So, and yes, the many faces of Jusetsu is easily making her as like one of my favorite characters of the season. She's definitely up there for waifu of the season just by the different faces of Jusetsu. So yeah, really enjoying it. I really, really recommend it. It's going to be, I think, between this one and Bibliophile Princess, probably this one more so, easily going to turn into that gem of the season that nobody watches.
Yeah.
The one that everybody that complains about, oh, anime is the same. It's all isekais. Why isn't there no unique anime out there? And then you go, did you watch Raven in the Inner Palace? And they'll go, what's that? There you go. It's like, stop looking at what's at the top of the anime chart. Look down and you'll find these very unique period piece drama mysteries that you don't get anywhere else. Why won't you give these a shot when you're complaining about the isekai that's at the top of the list? Anyways, rant over. I need to make a video on that soon. Like, it keeps hitting me in the head, like, this idea of, like, it's the what's an ohihei, the joke that we always say on the podcast. It's the, you have all these options and you always look at the very top and go, oh, it's just another shonen isekai slash whatever. And it's like, but this is what we're here for. This is what we're here for, to show you guys that there is stuff that is extremely unique and does something so different that unfortunately will not get the eyeballs of anybody because it's not at the top of the chart. So yeah, watch this in Bibliophile Princess. But we'll get into Bibliophile Princess. I don't know if... No, it's not in this one, no. But yeah, moving forward. We have... I've somehow gotten stronger when I improve my farm-related skills. One of those shows that's probably going to have more viewership than Raven of the Inner Palace, which is extremely disappointing. I don't know. I kind of would look that up. I'll look that up when Chris is doing his thoughts on this show. But I'm going to say I'm 100% positive this probably has more viewers on MAL than Raven. But anyways, that's fine. People are allowed to enjoy this show. I'm not saying it that way. The Japanese title is Nomen Kanren no Skill Baka Agatatara Nezuka. Nezuko? No, Nezuka Tsuyoku Nata. This one's streaming on High Dive, running for 12 episodes, done by Studio ACAT. God, now I know who to blame. A light novel is a source. The genres are adventure, fantasy, slice of life. And series composition is by Toko Machida, who again has done a lot of really good stuff. So really like their work. So yeah, this one opens up with a guy named Al Wayne. And Al Wayne, just love his name, Al Wayne loves farming. He's basically trying to fall in the footsteps of his parents and become a great farmer. And so all of his life is focused on just maxing out all farm stuff. And it does kind of give a sense of this almost like a gamey world. It's not, it hasn't established as any isekai. It's not established that it's a video game world. It's just this guy's in this fantasy setting and it has gaming mechanics to it, like status screens and stuff like that. And really early on, we kind of point out the fact that Al Wayne has finally maxed out this one skill. His friend shows up and is like, yeah, man, that's crazy. I was just surprised the fact that you maxed out you got to level 10 fishing and you just started it, and I'm a fisherman, and I haven't even got to level 10. So it kind of gives a sense that Al Wayne levels up things really quickly, and he's got a lot of high skills and different trades and stuff like that. And it seems like this is all kind of unlocked this one thing that kind of exponentially increases his stats. His overall stat average is super high, which completely shocks his friend. But Al doesn't care because he's got to get his deliveries to the castle, so he rushes off the castle. Off to the palace with his materials because he's farming and stuff and got to sell them off, and eventually runs into a kidnapping in progress. And oh, by the way, it happens to be the princess that was being kidnapped. So she wants to, you know, repay his helping her by letting him work at the palace, but he doesn't want to because he just wants to farm. And so she's offering him like crops and stuff, the royal palace farmland or whatever. That eventually leads into this guild mystery. He has to end up joining the adventure guild, and adventure guild signs him up for a job, and then eventually he finds out that the guild mistress lady behind the counter is in trouble because she used to be a part of this one village that was wiped out by this Ouroboros thing, dragon thing that feeds off of people's dread. And he always leaves one person alive, and that so happens to be the guildmistress lady. And so he's got to save her from the big Ouroboros dragon that's got, like, super high stats. And also power of – it wasn't the power of friendship. It was the power of positivity. He's able to take out the dragon.
Power of hope.
Hope. Oh, yeah, that's right. There was, like, this guy, Cecil, that was a part of the council of the royal family, and he turned out to be a demon lord captain or something and wanted to take down the kingdom, but that failed because Alwayn used his hoe on the ground and it destroyed him.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Oh, he tilled the ground with with his insane abilities of tilling ground, and it took out the... I like how when the Ouroboros tried to, like, consume Alwayn's mind, and I think he was looking for, like, negativity. All he found in Alwayn's mind was him tilling the ground. Okay, there's funny parts of the show. Go, Chris. What's your thoughts on... I've somehow gotten stronger when I somehow managed to boot up a Windows 98 computer and render a dragon.
Okay. I forgot about that.
I wanted to remind you before you started.
This show, I wanted it to be fun. I really did. It's one of those things that I hope that they pull something out that will pull it together. Because right now, I found more entertainment by Andrew telling us about the show more than I did the show itself. He's reminding me of things that I've kind of almost put out of my mind because of the fact that I don't know. I'm not going to say I've glazed over watching it, but when it comes down to it, I'm not engaged in the show. Despair versus hope thing was kind of like, and even when they finally climax that arc, it was like, okay, nothing about the show.
Transform my arms and legs into dragons.
Yeah, I can turn my arms into dragon stuff.
I have a party trick. I was like, okay, Aqua,
right?
Everybody's celebrating. She's transforming into dragon parts, and everybody going, yay! And it's almost like Aqua there with the little fountain.
Everybody going, pachi 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 pachi. Okay, let's move on from this joke. It's not that funny.
They thought they were killing it. They're like, man, this is such a good joke. Let's keep telling this joke that she can transform.
That's the nutshell of the show. I mean, you have more fun making fun of this show than the show itself. I'm literally struggling.
Like how he got this cape from the guildmistress lady that ended up being from her brother, who was like literally, I don't know, 4 feet tall, and somehow it perfectly fits Wayne.
This show.
It's like, don't stop derailing me. The delivery guy's cool. I don't know.
No, you wait and watch. The delivery guy is overpowered because he ran so much. They're going to do that. I just seen that coming out. Because they did that, they've already set the precedence with Alwayn. Alwayn did farming, and then they turned it into him becoming an overpowered hero because he did farming for so long. They're going to turn the delivery guy, he's been running for so long that it's going to turn into making him into a hero.
Alwayn was like at 65,000 or something like that, average stat, and like, what was it, the heroes were 100,000? So he's almost there. He's probably there now. I don't know.
I don't know. I wanted to like this show. I'm hoping that they'll pull something together. The girls are not that enough to save the show. The main character, he's fine. He's annoying.
He's just so focused
on farming that nothing else matters to him.
The only reason he saved the kingdom was, at first he wasn't going to do it.
because
they were going by his crops.
Like, he was
going
to mess up his crops.
This big horde of demons are coming into the lands, and he's like, okay, well, they're not going through my crops, so I'm good. And then at some point he goes, wait, I have to stop them, because if they destroy the palace, that means I don't have anybody to sell my crops to. Crap, I gotta go get involved. He only cares about his crops, literally. That's all he cares about. And he's going to have a lot of hot girls around him, and he's going to be like, ah, Minduk Sai, I need to go back and get my crops. A jerk.
It is. It is what it is. I want to enjoy it, and I can't wait until they bring something together that makes this show actually worth its time. But as it stands right now, I'm meh.
That's pretty much what it comes down to for me. First of all, visually, it looks like garbage. Like, it's every now and then it animates something, but for the most part, it is mostly very either wonky character designs animating, or it's stills, or it's, again, really horrendous looking CGI dragons.
I said, why did they put a claymation in my...
That aside, I like that with, like, they had the characters running towards a screen with this backdrop of, like, a full CGI forest and this dragon going... Anyways, putting that aside, the other thing of this show, I guess, is the crux of it is OPMC, plus he's a farmer. That's the joke. There was, like, a little bit of a sense of, like, Million Lives. I'm sitting on the Million Lives, and the idea of that one, he was, like, a farmer. He was given class farmer, so he's out there with literally farming tools. But it is the concept of he's obsessed with trade skills and farming, and that's what made him somehow super overpowered. Insert, I'm obsessed with farming jokes. That's literally the show. It's OP character, insert mechanic, which is he's obsessed with farming, and equals be overpowered with farming jokes. That's really what it kind of comes down to. And I think for the most part, it's had a couple chuckle points for me. I mean, the absurdity of somebody slamming a hoe into the ground, a farming tool for YouTube purposes here, a farming tool into the ground, and it destroys the demon captain guy's entire army was funny. And then beyond that, it's like, okay, that's the gist. He's obsessed with farming. Everything is around farming. Oh, do I get involved with this? Well, does it affect my farming? I'm going to get involved with it or not. And I think for the most part, none of that has really been kind of hitting ever since that initial absurdity of the farming tool destroying an army. For the most part, the characters aren't like, I don't hate the characters. They're fine. But for the most part, the story overall is just, and it was so weird because within like three episodes, it started getting really like super serious with the guild lady's whole story and how tragic that whole stuff was, but none of it really hit emotionally. And I think because it didn't tell it well enough. Like I felt nothing for the very tragic story they were telling. I felt really nothing in hearing that story, despite the fact they're literally talking to her dead brother and they're getting into how she was left alive and the only person to survive because he wanted to feed off her grief. And that feeds into his power to destroy the next village, which he leaves one person alive. That should have been more tragic and unsettling, but in the end, it's like we turn it into a dragon transformation joke, and it's like, all right, whatever lingering like seriousness of that story is there is gone. So, shrug. It didn't help that like Ouroboros and this other dragon were just full CGI too. So, I think that the crazy evil dragon wasn't like terrible looking. I mean, that it kind of helped that he was just like most all black, so it kind of blended into the background. I don't know, it's just not really, unfortunately, it's not really doing anything for me. Like overall, the show is just kind of very there. It's just existing, and it's not doing anything to make me angry, but at the same time, it's not really doing anything to entertain me. So if that's interesting to you, definitely check out I've somehow gotten stronger when I improve my farm related skills. That's a thing that's exists this season. And yes, it has 10,000 more users on MAL than Raven and the Inner Palace. Just let that sit there. Moving on. This is Spy X Family, Part 2, Season 2, whatever you want to call it. I don't care. It's the second core of the series. Streaming on Crunchyroll for 13 episodes. The studio is, of course, Wit Studio and Cloverworks. They're taking turns on episodes like they did the first season, part, whatever you want to call it. Source is a manga. Genres are action comedy. Continuing No Name's working on it with the music. Creator is Tatsuya Endo, who worked assistant work for Chainsaw Man, and the director Kazuhiro Furuhashi, which I think is still working on this part, did Rurouni Kenshin, Dororo, and Mobile Suit Gundam Unicorn. But yeah, the story so far, for those that are not aware of Spy Family, essentially opens up with a guy named Lloyd Foyger. It starts off with Twilight, which is a spy. He's known to have many faces, and he does a lot of his spy work. He kind of disguises himself as people and gets information. We get a sense that there's these two sides to this country, which are this continent, which is Westalis and Ostania. They're currently at peace, but there are people working in the background, political leaders and stuff, that are trying to cause a war between the two again. And so this group basically creates Operation Strix, which employs Twilight to go to Ostania and look into this guy named Donovan Desmond, who is supposedly working on something to cause a disaster or a war to happen. So he has to get together a wife and a child and go to this academy that Donovan runs and somehow get his child to be like one of these, what do they call them?
Starbear?
No. Like these high scholars. They have to get these pendants that show they do good, and if they get enough of them, they become one of these scholars. And then he can get to a meeting with Donovan, because that seems to be the only place that Donovan ever, you can talk to him. So yeah, he gets Anya, which ends up being somebody who's able to read minds, and from this orphanage. And then he finds this girl named Yor to be his wife, who just is trying to hide from the secret police by getting a husband. And she's also secretly an assassin. So it's a whole joke that he's a spy. You know, the wife is an assassin, and Anya's a mind reader that knows the two of their secrets. So that they're all trying to keep a secret. And going into the second season, we had right off the bat, this guy named Philip or Keith that was trying to get together this group of college students and stuff to strap bombs onto dogs and send them after this guy that was coming over from West Dallas to do this convention. And so they had to stop them. And that led to them getting Bond, which is their dog that can see the future. Because we don't have enough hidden quirks in this series that we have to have a dog that sees the future. But obviously only Anya can see it because she can read the dog's mind. So, yeah. What's your thoughts so far on this part?
I love it.
Oh, yeah. And Yor learned how to cook a stew. She learned how to cook specifically a stew. Sorry.
I love the show. And just going into this season, it doesn't feel like a lot has happened in the last few episodes. We outside of getting Bond and Yor learning how to cook stew
and stopping war,
and stopping war. It's one of those things that this show really revolves around the aspect of the keeping everything under wraps, and I like how they pull that off in a lot of cases of this. Going out to get a dog, and somehow that equals stopping a bomber from destroying a clock tower. That I love how that all plays out. And that I think that right now we're just at this point of slowly getting more and more of these stories out. I really want to know more about a lot of these characters, but at this time, it's just not time for that yet.
Yeah, the surprise that we really had so far with this part was definitely Sylvia. Like, I was really not expecting to get as much into Sylvia as I thought we would. She's what her title's a handler or whatever. She's pretty much like the main person that talks to Lloyd about, you know, their missions and stuff like that. And it really got heavy with her and her history that, obviously, it seems like her family, she lost most of all of her family, seemingly also her daughter, due to this war. And so she obviously doesn't want to have war happen again. And that's kind of been the underlying story of the entire series so far. It's goofy shenanigans around their secrets. Yes, part realizing, you know, the importance of family. And then this other side is the scars, but also the prevention of war itself. And obviously seeing that everybody has some sort of thing that drives them to prevent that from happening. Lloyd being that he was left on the battlefield, the ruined streets alone. He doesn't want to see it happen to a child again. And we've kind of seen that a little bit more with Sylvia as well. I loved her speech that she gave those students. Was like, does the students in Ostania not learn about this stuff? Like, learn about what happened with war? Like, have you guys ever taken a life? Have you ever had to eat boiled flesh? Have you ever seen family members go nuts through having to see the other side as monsters and cover their hands in blood? Like, she literally just laid it out to them. This shouldn't happen, and you guys want it to happen. I think it was really, really, really kind of like out of nowhere, which they do that here and there with the series, is every now and then it gets like really serious, but at the same time doesn't feel like it kind of sets in it, and it's able to kind of transition out of it really well. So I give them a lot of props for that. But overall, a lot of my enjoyment is around Anya and the shenanigans between their family. But every now and then getting these really great moments of the importance of what they're doing in family. Like with Yor, it was like At first, I wanted to do this because I needed to make sure that I secured my family because this is a part of my mission. Then eventually it turns into, oh, but now I realize the better benefit of this was that I got to see them smile. I got to be acknowledged by them. And that was what's more important. And Lloyd runs in that stuff a lot too, especially with the last season, but not so much this season so far. But yeah, I do love the new mechanic they've added. I think Bond is a great little thing to add to it because the problem we've always had with Anya is that she has this secret and she knows everybody's secret, but she can't tell anybody. They won't believe her, obviously, if she says, hey, by the way, I just seen this dog walk by and he was able to see our family and then Lloyd disappeared. So obviously something's wrong with Lloyd. It kind of turns this whole thing of Anya's only able to confine in Bond and Bond's only able to give the message of what he sees to Anya. And it creates this really cool chemistry. I'm kind of curious if that'll turn into like a... I joked about it with my videos, this idea of the secret agent Anya, where like at some point Lloyd and their entire group of wise is going to start to believe that there's some other secret agent out there that's working behind the scenes. But it actually turns out to be Anya because she's able to see things and fix them before Lloyd and them can fix it. I think that'd be a lot of fun. But yeah, I do really still enjoy this series. I think the only thing that I've kind of mentioned several times in my videos and stuff that I'm kind of a little bit let down at this point is we just don't get to see Yor in action. Like, we get to see her beat up bad guys every now and then, punch people that do bad things to Anya, but we don't get to see her do her job. Like, at this point, I don't even know if she does her job anymore, and it's kind of weird that they showed her at the scene of one assassination in episode 2, and we've never seen her do a job ever since then, which makes you kind of start to wonder if she still does her job. But cool. I think that's kind of a difficulty, but at the same time, I understand why they don't do it, because then you see her covered in blood, and she's obviously just ended somebody's life, and that's not fun. But,
well, I mean, I was excited about this episode that was supposed to be Yor centered, and
it was only half.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was more centered around her learning how to make stew, and it was like, oh,
which did technically get into her and her brother and their relationship and their parents, but that again, that lies into what I believe this writer kind of is at this point known for with Spike's family is it's that. They don't like to sit in things. They don't like to get too dark. But I don't know if that's just an attribute of them feeling like they don't want to get too dark for the fans of it.
And I don't necessarily need Yor to go dark.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things that I think that she's balanced well. This character that has this dark past, but not necessarily staining her with that dark past. And I think that they balance that well of her having that, knowing that she's lethal and knowing that she's dangerous, but she's...
It's like they write her into a hole. Like, they don't want to show her, you know, shed blood, but at the same time, they literally wrote her that way. And so it's kind of funny that they don't show it. I guess my point more is in the idea that we only get to see her in action when it's a comedy beat. Lloyd's constantly doing stuff behind the background and trying to stop things from happening, whereas with Yor, we never see it. She just kicks people, and she kicks cars, and she kicks bulls. But she doesn't, like, go out, like, this is a mission that if this guy gets to this airport, it will cause a war. And so she has to go out there and take somebody out. You never get something like that. Like, she's actually doing a job. No, I don't need to see her cut somebody's throat, but imply that she goes there and does something and gets the target and then cuts
scene. Well, and I think that would be a really cool additive of having her as doing the same thing that Lloyd's doing, but from her side, because effectively the interesting tidbit about
she's just always chasing Anya. That's really all she's doing.
She's technically against Lloyd, theoretically, because she's working for the government that Lloyd is technically undermining to prevent war. But when it comes down to it, he is technically against them. He is a spy that literally Yor's brother
is working under.
I got the impression
her brother is working for the secret police of Astania. Obviously Lloyd is working for Westalis's wise group, but I don't think they've ever actually specifically said
it was just one of those kind of implications, but they have not actually said that.
She is her stated goal is that she wants to essentially protect the people around her, so that would imply that she is working for Astania. It just hasn't really specifically said, I don't know, but yeah. I don't like Yori still. I still don't like Yuri. At least he was pretty toned down this recent time that he showed up. I was like, okay, thank you for keeping him under wraps this time. He was so annoying the first time we met him.
eating the nasty food and throwing up in between bites. That was just great.
Yeah. But no, I still love the show. I'm looking forward to the next episode because we have the return of Elegance. Henry is going to show up next episode. I really do still believe at this point the episodes that are usually the best for me is always Anya at school, because Damien and Anya and just shenanigans and Becky, all that stuff is just super fun. But it's just a really great series. I've been enjoying it a lot and I still enjoy it. I won't say that it's on like the incredible high that I was in the first part early on. It's kind of stabilized to a show that I just really enjoy every single episode of. So, there we go. We'll see. Spike's family. Moving on, we have Uzaki-chan wants to hang out, or Uzaki-chan wa asobitai. This one is streaming on... It's probably streaming on Funimation. I still have Funimation in there. It's streaming on Crunchyroll. The studio is ENGI, the source is a manga, and the genres are slice of life, comedy, ecchi. But yeah, this one, of course, for those who don't know about the series, Uzaki-chan wants to hang out. Of course, it's being second season. Essentially opens up with Hana and Shinichi, which Shinichi is just starting, or he's been at the school for a while, and then his kohai starts going to the same school as he's going to, this university, and she immediately recognized him, that they used to be a part of this swimming club together, and she really did look up to him back then, and now she's being reunited with him. And the whole thing that she really hits him heavy on is that he's kind of always sitting around and not really interacting with anybody, so she decides to essentially interact with him and say, "You are a loner," and criticizes him constantly and tries to get him to go out and do things because he's always been kind of a loner and just focused on playing video games and being by himself. So she's just kind of keeps harping on him, and eventually doki dokis happen. And this really stupid looking cat shows up every now and then.
Stupid cat.
I hate the cat so much. I really hate the cat. Every time he's on the screen, he's like, just skip.
Just cut that one little part out. Yeah, and then it'll be a perfect
whenever somebody releases a Blu-ray of this, have the cat is out of the picture cut version.
I absolutely love this show. And having this second season of kind of pushing characters together is absolutely fantastic. I really, really love it. I to the point where even on Discord, I pointed out all this later joke that they've been doing with certain characters, and then the one thing that kind of sets the whole thing off is another character that of course that one character would set that off. But I love it. I really do enjoy the interactions. I loved him last season. I love him this season. I absolutely am in love with Hana. She is perfect. I love Uzaki. So yeah, I still absolutely enjoying it in the second season just as much as I loved it in the first season. Go watch it.
Some people are going to really hate me. I don't like the second season. I've not enjoyed the second season really at all. Reasons why. I'm in agreement that I do appreciate that this season feels like it's really ramping up the relationship. It was something that was kind of stirred up probably like halfway through the first season, and it kind of just kept getting more and more stirred up as it got to the end of the first season. And the second season really does feel like it's trying to, at least, have these two realize what's going on between the two of them. Now, the problem that I have with the season is that everything that I enjoyed about the first season is gone. Like, there's barely any ecchi. There's barely any, like, oops shenanigans that's kind of happening, which, yes, some people can say is, like, tropish, but I always felt the thing that was refreshing about Uzaki-chan Wants to Hang Out is that those interactions, those oops ecchi moments of the first season was so much better done than most any other show. Like, they did something unique and different with it. One of those key things being that the idea that Uzaki doesn't immediately turn and punch the living crap out of the main character because it wasn't really his fault, but they still do it anyways because that's how ecchi oops anime does. But a lot of the, like, ecchi encounters they had with the first season was absolutely hilarious and stuff that I really didn't see anywhere else. Like, the getting stuck in the bush. That's, like, the most like the most iconic scene that we had with Uzaki-chan was the getting stuck in the bush and people walking by and seeing them. That stuff was great. I'm not getting that with this season. What I'm getting in this season is really a lot of we're getting into the will they, won't they. It feels like I've had nothing but will they, won't they for, what, 4 or 5 episodes? And in between the whole will they, won't they is the narration of, I didn't mind her in the first season. I'm now sick of her. Ami Asai is so annoying in this season, and they keep focusing on her. And yes, they're kind of transitioning and trying to focus on the other guy as well, because they're kind of, they're working together to try to get Uzaki and Sakurai together. And I didn't mind them in the first season, and now I'm getting tired of them, because it seems like it's always in their head. Well, we got to get them together. Let's do something to get them together. Let's do this. We have this plan. Let's get them together. Oh my gosh, I really want to see them together. Why aren't they together yet? Why are these two aren't together yet? It's like, I can't stand watching this over and over again. Please do something. Please show, do something fun, funny, something besides just being in these guys' heads. Will they, won't they, these two others. That stuff's getting tiring. I think the only enjoyment I've gotten out this entire season was like the last scene of this recent episode where it has, yes, he calls mom by her first name, and that sets Hana off. But Urzaki, if you want to call her that. I was trying to call her Hana because she's really upset that her mom's getting her first name read. I don't know. And then Kat. I don't know. It's been a very disappointing season. It's not like it's terrible. It's been very blah. Like it's been kind of a boring. It's kind of been borderline so boring that I'm starting to point out like architectural inconsistencies in buildings. Yes, I did that because one of the houses had like blinds on the porch door that was overlaying the porch's rail. Anyways, it's fine. Just it's definitely not to the caliber of first season. I hope it starts to turn things around, but so far it's been pretty much a snooze for me, unfortunately, even though I really do love Uzaki. So, and I actually like her mom more. Her mom's great. Her mom's like the funniest jokes. Like, it's just her really thinking this guy's after her and that she's gonna break up the relationship with her daughter. Anyways, there you go. Uzaki-chan wants to hang out, second season. Let's move on to Beast Tamer. Yusha Party Wo Suiho Sarata Beast Tamer Saikyoshu no Nekomimi Shoujo to Dau. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll running for 13 episodes. Studio is EMT Square. The source is a light novel. The genres are action fantasy. Director is Atsushi Nigorikawa, who did Love Tyrant, Between the Sky and the Sea, and Animated Training. And series composition by Takashi Aoshima, who did Onipan, Kakushigoto, Uzaki-chan Wants to Hang Out, Kuma Bear, and Uzumaid. This one opens up following a guy named Rein Shroud. And Rein Shroud, in the opening segments, we find out that he's a beast tamer, which is like this class that everybody looks down upon. It's like the worst class, able to tame random creatures in the world and use them. And he is a part of the Heroes Party, who's going out and adventuring around and doing quests and stuff. And his whole role that they kind of put him in is that he just tames creatures to carry their stuff and different creatures to scout ahead. That's pretty much all he does. And the Heroes Party at this point has decided they want to kick him out because he's a waste of space, basically. He doesn't do much to contribute, and they always have to keep protecting him. So they kick him out, and they criticize him on the way out, take his equipment that they claim that they got him. And then he's pretty much in a slump at that point, realizing he's been kicked out. But then after some kids kind of talked to him and talked about how great he is and how it's so cool that he's a part of the Hero Party, he decides that he's going to become an adventurer. And so he goes to the Adventure Guild, learns all the basic information about the Adventure Guild, and then sets out to do his exam quest, which requires him to kill some goblins and get some herbs. And eventually stumbles upon this cat spirit, which is Kanade. And Kanade is being attacked by this tiger. He tries to help her, fails miserably. Then she does one final blow on the tiger and takes it down. And they kind of converse for a little bit. Rein kind of divulges to this cat spirit that he's, you know, got kicked from the Heroes Party. And she quickly goes, why? You're incredible. Like, I knew something. The moment I seen you, something clicked in me. I knew that there was something special about you. The joke that you kind of get throughout the entirety of at least these first 4 episodes or so is that Rein, he's a beast tamer, which is not really that special, but he's a very special one. Like, he does things that no other beast tamer can do. Like, most can only tame one animal at a time, one creature at a time. But he's able to tame, like, hundreds. He's very special. He just doesn't realize it. And yes, she realized that he's possibly going to be one of these kind of very rare cases of beast tamers that can actually tame, what they call them, the
ultimate spirits,
something like that, which are, yes, cat spirits, dragons, and fairies and stuff like that, spirits. So she's like, well, try to tame me. And he's like, okay, well, if you're okay with it. And sure enough, he's able to tame this very rare cat spirit. And so the oddity that comes from that as well is that he shares all of her stats. So cue them going on adventures together, kind of hitting a little bit heavy on the idea that Kanade believes that Ryan is hiding his own insecurities and anger about being kicked out of the party, Heroes Party. At the same time, Heroes Party is on the sidelines, realizing how incredible he was and how they really can't replace him. So they want to use him again. And eventually he runs into Tanya, who is a dragon spirit, beats her and is able to tame her and so on and so forth. It's basically Rise of the Shield Hero, Chris. I'm just kidding. I got so much flack because I said that the OP and there's certain things that are similar to Shield Hero. So everybody got angry on YouTube. It's fine. I'm used to people getting weird things out of what I say. It was a fun comparison and it's Mad Kids. Literally the OP is Mad Kids. You know they were going for that. It's not, though. The show itself is not Shield Hero. It's just I'm just pointing out that there's some similarities, and it seemed like they were obviously going for that with the OP.
You're
going
to get in trouble again.
I am. And I'm going to say, it's definitely
good
not.
Job.
It's no, what's the interesting thing is that some people were saying, no, it's more like Banished from the Heroes Party. I'm like, yeah, because he got kicked out of the Heroes Party, but what else? Like, he doesn't open up a shop. Ryan doesn't open up a shop. He doesn't get with this princess from a kingdom that his Heroes Party interacted with at some point. His sister isn't the hero. It's some doofus named Orlando, who's a jerk.
He's a jerk.
He's definitely not as cute as the sister from Banished from the Heroes Party. Anyways, what's your thoughts on this show?
I'm just mildly warm on this show. I do enjoy it. I like Rain. I like the girls. I can't wait until the Kitsune shows up. But when it comes down to it, it's not really moving at, I'm not going to say it's not moving at a good pace. It's literally adding a girl every episode or two. So it's not like we're not getting to a point at some point, but at the same time, I don't have a lot of drive to continue going. It's not, and that might be the point. It might be a slice of life of some sort where we're just looking at his life. But when it comes down to it, it doesn't feel like that. It feels like we're getting to some kind of an opening. However, I do like the fact that we keep getting things from the Heroes Party's perspective of, hey, maybe we were wrong in letting Rain go, and I do kind of like that. This kind of the news keeps coming back to them in some way, shape, or form, like the other beast tamer going in and saying, what are you talking about? I can't do that. That's not normal. And them going, no, you're kidding, right? Rain was actually good. So stuff like that, I kind of like that the Hero Party getting their just desserts and hopefully, and I'm assuming at some point them going, okay, maybe we were a little bit hard on them and actually at some point facing that. And so I think that there is some things in there that I kind of want to see transpire, but at the same time, it's just mildly warm that I'm interested in just generally following it as a good little popcorn show.
The show's great because Kanade, cat girl, best girl, that's all. Now, Tanya was great, too. Astafo, obviously. But, yeah, Tanya, the girls are great in the show so far. Like, I really do like them. They're really cute. They definitely do a great job of animating them. And it's hard not to love the female characters that are in the show. They're really lovable. I really do like, Kanade is kind of like the super positive side and wants to kind of pull Ryan out of whatever darkness that she believes that he's in that he doesn't ever express. And at the same time, Tanya is just really kind of the tsundere, really open about what she is, but you can't really be open about it because she's literally a dragon. So every time she's in the town, they literally had to tell everybody in the town that she is some weird cosplayer. But no, they've been a lot of fun. I really do enjoy them, which is funny because they say that she's like a cosplayer dragon so that nobody knows that she's a dragon. But at the same time, it's like, why don't you do the same thing for Kanade? Because she's literally supposed to be like the super rare species. Like, Kanade is super rare. Like, they hit on it once where somebody had, like, go, oh, you're a cat spirit. Let me pull you in. And that was kind of like, that's why she likes Ryan, is because he didn't take advantage of her, where everybody else sees that she's rare and wants to take advantage of her. But they're really great. I really do like the girls in the show so far. Outside of that, Shrug. Like, the entire show is kind of Shrug. Like, the only reason I'm really so far watching is because I enjoy Kanade and Tanya. The overall show itself is, I think my biggest disappointment that's in this show so far is that the concept that it kind of opened it up with is that Ryan tames creatures. They go out and do stuff for him. That was his unique thing, is that he's really clever and he does have the ability to tame a lot of things. And so he does utilize that to his advantage. So if there's a bandit, a cave full of bandits, he sends in a bunch of hornets that paralyze people. And that's his way of getting around the situation. When he fought Tanya, he decided to employ a bunch of birds that carried this poison that paralyzed her. So it's kind of clever in that idea. The thing that kind of ruined that concept, that mechanic, is that the moment that he tames these girls, he becomes super overpowered. And so he doesn't really need the girls anymore. Like, I thought it was going to turn into a thing where he tames them and they go out and they fight for him. And so Kanade is going in there and kicking the crap out of stuff. And Tanya's blowing things away with magic. No, it's kind of turning into, no, Ryan punches everything and Ryan blows everything up with magic. Like, he's no longer unique in the idea that he is he's the weak one that is utilizing his smarts and his two girls to handle things. It's just turning into, he's just them. So what's the point in them even being there? I thought that was a little bit disappointing in that regard. The thing that was kind of, besides the girls that I really do like, the element that was kind of cool in the show itself was the hero element. I typically don't like the hero party idea. Like with Banished from the Heroes Party, didn't care. they did something really interesting with the sister, obviously. Even Shield Hero, I hate when those heroes are on the freaking screen. They only exist to be dumb and terrible. With this one, I'm sort of intrigued by what they will possibly do. And I'm sure, opening up the next episode, they're going to get into that because they literally just walked up to Ryan. But my curiosity is going to be in the idea is, what are they going to do? Is it going to be, hey, Ryan, we want you back? And then Ryan, through his own, I don't know, PTSD, it seems like they're trying to imply, goes, okay. And then the other girls are going, why are you doing this? They literally kicked you out. And then he just still goes because he feels an obligation. Or is it going to turn this thing where the hero party is the hero party? Can they technically force him physically because they are technically the hero's party? You would assume they're really strong. That's going to be the question. Does it turn into him becoming essentially forced? Or does it just turn into a battle between the two of them? And in the end, Ryan beats him up and they have to walk away licking their wounds. I'm curious how they're going to tie that stuff together because they've been technically hitting on it for the entirety of the show so far as being really only the only plot line this series has. Like, yes, it's him taming random girls, but literally the only plot line in the show itself is that he was from the Heroes Party and the Heroes Party wants to come back and get him. Will that turn into something interesting? I don't know, but that at this point, that's the only carrot on the stick that we have. So, and I think that's kind of a sign of a fear that I have for the series, is if that doesn't turn into being some really cool plot line, it's going to be like a huge disappointment.
It really will. I mean, like I said, that's kind of the one thing that is kind of out there that is, I kind of want to see that, is this one aspect of the hero party and them getting their just desserts at some point. I mean, obviously, we've got more girls to go, but when it comes down to it, the most interesting aspect is, how is the hero party going to incorporate into this?
Yeah, I'm not saying that the element of him moving on with his life and finding joy is not there. It's just I don't think they're even trying to. Like, again, the only indication that we get that he is struggling and that he's moving on is the very beginning when he's like, crap, I got kicked out. What do I do? Oh, Adventure Guild. That was it. And then going forward was when Kanade is in the bed and he's sleeping on the ground. She's going, I want him to be happy. And I feel like somewhere deep in there, he's not happy. And I want to see him smile. Kanade is thinking that he is in despair, but he doesn't show it. So we'll see. We'll see if that actually turns out. The other interesting thing that I'm kind of curious about is it kind of implies a little bit of dark. There's a dark feel here, mainly implied by Lean, which is their mage. In the Heroes Party, there's a girl named Lean. At some point, again, when this beast tamer that they employed after Ryan is useless. And they're like, why don't you tame a whole bunch of creatures? And he's like, that's impossible. And she's like, you're lying. They had just abandoned a carriage, which Ryan saves, but they abandoned their quest. And so she was like, we can't have that reflect on the hero's party. So you're going to take the blame. Like, she forces this tamer to take all the blame of it. And the way that she forces him is saying, I have, like, was it like 100 and something spells. I'm going to use every one on you, kill you multiple times, and then Mina here, which is their priest, is going to resurrect you every time until you accept that you're going to take the blame. It's a little bit dark. I don't know if that's going to lead into their experience running to each other, but it really does feel like they're really painting the hero's party as super bad. I mean, you got the indication of that when he said he realized at some point, based on those kids at the very beginning, going, you're the only cool hero. We really like you. And then he realizes, oh, yeah, that's right. Whenever I go to shops, everybody looks at me like, oh, crap, he's part of the hero party because they hate everybody so much, except for Ryan. So we'll see. We'll see if it actually turns into something interesting with that whole aspect or if it just turns into hang out with cute Kanade and Tanya, which I'm fine with. Like I said, I really like Kanade and Tanya. It's just the overall story. We'll see if anything happens. So, yeah, that's Beast Tamer. It's literally Shield Hero. I'm going to get so much hate. Moving on, Mobile Suit Gundam, The Witch from Mercury. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll. Supposedly is going to have a split core, a second core coming in spring of next year, which is kind of unfortunate, but it is what it is. Of course, being done by Sunrise because it's Gundam. It's an original because it's Gundam. And the director is Hiroshi Kobayashi, who did Kiznaiver and Spriggan. Script work by Ichiro Okuchi, who did Code Geass, Kito, The Exiled, and Kamen Rider Iron Fortress, as well as Skate Infinity. So, yeah, this one opens up in Adstella 122. I don't know if that was I think it was the beginning of this season. Of course, we had a prelude. For those who don't know, there is a episode zero prelude of The Witch from Mercury. It really does open up, showing that there's all these corporations. Mankind's going into space. There's all these corporations that build mobile suits. And with that whole aspect is that there is a little bit of control via who produces the mobile suits. So you do have like a lot of corporations that are essentially turning on other corporations just to take them out because they want to be the one that builds the premier mobile suits for different groups of armies and stuff like that. So the group that we kind of follow, which is the main group, ends up kind of getting turned on. They come in and they wipe out everybody out of this industry that's trying to create this stuff. And then we jump forward to the current time, which I think it was Adstella 122, where we follow Suetta, who starts to go to an academy that is essentially funded by one of the major corporation groups of the mobile suits. And you quickly find out in this academy, all the students that are main figure characters are pretty much children of what happened, the different corporations' owners and heads and leads. So, yeah, the other main kind of storyline that's within this whole thing is that there is this gun-to-arm technology that they were trying to put into the Gundams themselves, which they were trying to produce Gundams. And that gun-to-arm technology was developed from this other technology, which works really great, but at the same time, when it's infused into a whole mobile suit, into a mobile suit itself, it causes damage to the pilot itself. So they use that as an excuse to essentially outlaw Gundams. And so the existence of Gundams should not happen anymore. They should have been wiped out. Well, this girl, Suetta, who's now coming to this academy, still has that Gundam that they ran away with at the very beginning. And so they quickly acknowledge that that is a thing that should not exist, and that turns into a whole story beat. Additionally, you do have the aspect of racism between both the Earthians and the Spatians. So people that are from Earth or origin from Earth itself are looked down upon by people that are in space or called Spatians, and vice versa. So there's a little bit of that aspect going on as well. So, but yeah, Suetta coming to that school, quickly learning about this kind of dueling system that this school has, which is if you duel somebody, you can put terms to it and pretty much, you know, force weddings or kick somebody out of the school or whatever. Everything is absolute with the duels themselves. And she gets quickly swept up in this duel involving this Mjornin and this Guil. And they're apparently going to get married. And so Suetta beating Guil ends up being the now bridegroom of Mjornin. And Mjornin just wants to leave and go to Earth. So that whole thing's happening. So
she has simple requests.
And then they went to school in episode 4. They actually had a class. I laughed about that. Like, episode 4 finally comes out, and we're finally in a classroom. It's like, oh, okay, we've been dueling and fighting and all this political intrigue, and then finally Suetta's in a classroom. Yeah, your thoughts so far?
It's fine. I mean,
it's... Oh, yeah, and Choo-Choo. I'm sorry, Choo-Choo. There you go. Sorry, what are your thoughts?
How do I put this?
Careful, Chris. You're going to get Gundam fans
mad. I know, right? I want this to feel more like a Gundam. And I don't think that we're far enough into it to actually get that feel. Right now, it's if Gundam was set in a school setting, that's what we would have here. And it's got its own flavor that I do really enjoy. I enjoy Suetta and how she's kind of interacting with a lot of these characters and building up this school of all these characters and how they interact and how they portray a kind of a mecha school. I like that. And so at some point, I'm sure that we're going to start seeing Gundam really show forward as this is actually a Gundam. But right now, we're still in school. So take that for what it is. I don't hate it because I like this new interesting twist on the Gundam franchise, but understand that is with me saying it doesn't feel really like Gundam yet. It feels more like a school setting that has Gundams in it. So I all in all, I like it. It's fine. It's just it doesn't feel like my normal Gundam.
What is your normal Gundam? Flying around and having fights at the end of every episode. Space travel and fights, Gundam fights at the end of each episode. No, I absolutely love this show. I think it's an interesting new take on the Gundam formula. I think this, it's been quoted somewhere that they're pretty much trying to capture a new audience. They're obviously trying to pull in newer, younger audiences into the series. And I think a lot of that has to do with Suetta and the style they've kind of created with her character archetype. It's not your usual main character is a young boy who just whines inside of the Gundam every 2 seconds and their dad slaps him every now and then. No, I think the thing that I enjoy most about this is it's trying to kind of balance between, I want to agree with the idea that this is a school Gundam essentially, but it's not really like, it's not living in that. Like I joked about, technically the first classroom and exam scene we had was in episode 4. And it was very brief. We didn't even have a classroom. It was just they were in the classroom and then it cut scenes. It really does feel like they're trying to really balance, yes, Suetta being at a school, not necessarily attending school, but being in a school setting in order to essentially meet these other students who are children of the previous generation, the ones that are in control. The aspect they're really doing here is it almost feels like you're taking the usual political story beats of your usual Gundam, which is, yes, space politics. You have different corporations. Usually it's the Federation versus the Zeon or whatever. But this one's really kind of painting it more in it's a corporation, which makes sense because in this world, the corporations are in power. Money is power. And yes, the main union of these corporations that is able to develop the primary source of these mechas is the one that has both military and financial power. And so it is pretty much putting it as this corporation is power. They don't want to say it, but they are literally the rulers of the universe because they have the power and the money. And what that kind of essentially trickles down to is this academy that these kids are a part of is a branch of that corporation. It's a university funded by the corporations, which is, again, the powers. And what that's sort of doing is it's allowing it to be almost a generational war. What I feel like they're kind of getting into is having this idea that this country bumpkin Suetta, who was, you know, basically she had to flee off to Mercury. She's now coming back into the picture of the ruins of what was left behind and now going into the school where she is now interacting with children of this previous catastrophe. And what's happening is you have, yes, the Spacians versus the Earthians, but also the remains of the rubble that was caused in the past, which was the destruction of this Earthian organization that was trying to advance technology. And so I think what's going to happen is having her being so disjointed from political powers, she's able to bridge the gap between all these groups of people, these children of these corporations, and eventually, again, like I believe is going to happen, eventually have them rise up and push against their parents who are controlling their lives and controlling the world itself, which I'm really curious to see what happens there. Like I said, it at its core, I feel like it's still going for you the usual Zeon, Char, you have a Char character, give me a break. Going for the usual political party, space politics, and stuff like that, but giving it a different face, I guess. A different paint job that's on the surface, which again, I think is the timid nature of Suetta coming in as almost a neutral party that's able to bridge people together.
Absolutely. I love her stutter.
Yeah. And I'm excited to see how that kind of evolves. I'm already kind of seeing how Suetta is evolving as a character. She has like a massive amounts of insecurity, but again, it's playing it differently than you typically get from a main character who's usually kind of whining and wanting to get it and go back to their room. It's just now it's this female timid character. So I'm liking it. I like there's so many characters I'm already loving. I'm loving the political intrigue. I'm loving how everything's kind of connecting together. I felt it was a little bit more cheesy in the idea that you have, yes, every child of every current corporation leaders in one school. But it makes sense, the idea that this is the corporation's owned university. And they do a lot of tests, and a lot of respect for those corporations within this group are based on what happens in those duels and what's happening in university, which makes sense to real universities in the real world. There's a lot of universities that are often beds for testing new technologies and stuff because that's what they get a lot of funding for. And so it kind of plays into that element as well. And yeah, I'm loving the chemistry, loving all the characters. I'm already fearing for the life of Nika. I think she's too pure and she will probably die at some point. I'm just making my predictions right now. Choo Choo was fantastic. She's literally Becca from Cyberpunk now in a Gundam. I just love her. Like, that punch was great. I'm loving all the characters. I'm loving the chemistry, loving the political intrigue. I'm loving how they're balancing the political and the character moments. They're doing very well of not sticking too much time to just people talking in a room to shenanigan moments or character moments or action moments. They're really balancing a lot of that stuff very well. And there is some Gundams in the past that I've watched where it's like too much political stuff, I'm getting bored, or it's too much, you know, just flying around in mechas or something. This is doing a really good job of balancing it. It looks really great. There's a couple CGI usage that is kind of a eh, but for the most part, it looks really fantastic. There's Sunrise is the company if you want to have actually drawn 2D mecha, and they're doing a great job of it. So I'm looking forward to more. I love it. So, and if you like Gundam 2, go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/otakuspirit, because I cover it on a weekly basis. Moving on, we have management of Novus Alchemist, or Shinmai Rinkinjutsu Sushi no Tenpo Kei. This one is streaming on High Dive, running for 12 episodes, done by Studio ENGI. The source is light novel. The genres are fantasy, slice of life. The director is Hiroshi Ikihata, who did Magical Circle Guru Guru, Tanikawa Under the Moon for You, or Over the Moon for You, and See You Life. Series composition by Shigeru Murakoshi, who did Gymnastic Samurais, I'm Quitting Heroing, and Zombieland Saga. So yeah, this one opens up falling girl named Sarasa, as we quickly find out, has not had a good life. it kind of opens up, she was very young. She used to enjoy hanging out in her parents' shop. Her parents were kind of, you know, traders and stuff like that. And at some point, her parents go off to do some sort of delivery. And then news came back that some bandits attacked the carriage and killed her parents. And that kind of left her stranded. You kind of get a sense at her funeral that her parents were double-crossed, that these people wanted to steal the deed to her family's shop, and they got what they wanted. She gets shipped off to an orphanage. At the orphanage, she just kind of focuses on essentially the same life that her parents did. She wants to focus on being an alchemist and all this kind of trade. So she just, as ever, all the kids at the orphanage are having fun, she's just stuck in her books. She's just studying. And this kind of transfers that she learned about this one orphan that was at this same facility, comes to visit. They had apparently went off to this Royal Academy and learned to be alchemists. And so she's like, can I do that too? And he's like, yeah, sure enough. And so she goes to join the Royal Academy, ends up going to the exam, completely aces it, which was kind of funny. And then eventually, through like the help of her master that she started to tutelage under at the same time, gets her own shop out in the sticks. And so she moves out there, opens up her own shop, meets the villagers there, and becomes an alchemist of the area. So, yeah, your thoughts on management of Novus Alchemist, which is totally not Atelier Ryza.
It's totally not. That's exactly where I was going to.
her character design is so right. I mean, minus the thighs. She's so right. Like, she has the hat. She got the same almost hair length. It just looks like Ryza. Sorry.
One of the aspects that I absolutely love about this is literally all my ateliers just being condensed into one big Osho.
Fun fact. Same exact month that the source material of this came out. What do you think came out? Atelier Ryza. The same exact month. Literally. I thought that was funny. Sorry. Go ahead.
So, and that's one thing that I've absolutely loved about this. I love Atelier, and having kind of an anime version of it literally is just, I'm eating it up. I just love this. I from the opening up your own shop, the going out and gathering your own materials, the building up
the Alchemy Works book. You gotta fill that out. You gotta finish them all.
And having all these characters come together, and that you have your gatherers who are kind of joint. I don't know if they're going to do a party thing later, but I hope they do. I kind of want to see them going out there and doing kind of combination attacks and stuff like that. Literally, this show is feeding all those little tidbits that it's actually one of the Atelier series. So, yes, I'm absolutely loving it. Is it the greatest show ever? No, I don't care if it's the greatest show ever. It's Atelier. So, yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I this show is a huge surprise for me. I really was. It's just kind of one of those shows where I turn it on and I'm like, all right, let's just get this over with. I had zero expectations for it. Yes, I with Chris really love Atelier games. I used to play pretty much all of them ever since the PS3 era. Absolutely love them. I think I pretty much have all of them on my Vita. And I was at some point trying to get them all on Switch as well, which is a really bad spiral to go down when you keep buying the same games over and over again so you can get them all on one console. But no, I really do love the Atelier game series, and I really felt like, again, based on the cover art of this, it was going to be the same thing. But I really wasn't expecting that going into it. I'm like, this is going to be probably a throwaway show. Fire it up. Obviously, from the very beginning, I feel really bad for Sasarasa. She just had not a good life. And then adding the fact that she pretty much lived her entire life focusing on her studies, and even when she was into the school, university, she focused on her studies and part-time job and being under the tutelage of this alchemist. That was her focus. So she never made friends. So she's completely inadequate for social interactions with people. And I really like the fact that following her exam and getting her license and then going out and starting her own shop, which she chose purposely. I guess she can work under her master, but she chose specifically, I need to break out on my own. Otherwise, I'm going to always be reliant on my master. And that kind of spirals into not her working under somebody else, but, oh, by the way, I'm buying you a shop. Go open your own shop out in the sticks. Her having to essentially open up her own shop, but at the same time, feeling inadequate and not really knowing how to interact with other people. So it turns into an aspect of her insecurities of not only being in some random place where she doesn't know anybody there, feeling alone, but at the same time, not really being comfortable around other people. And that village being so welcoming of her, like they're like bringing her in and showing her around and giving her free stuff and building up her house and everything. But the entire time she thinks that she is less and that she's inadequate, almost to the point where she fears that because of how young she is, they're going to believe that she cannot do a proper job and that she will be inadequate. And the fact that they don't have an alchemist in the area, she's desired. Like, they want her to be there. So there is kind of a back and forth with that issue. And I think they do a really good job of having her have those insecurities and then eventually develop it into her gaining some confidence. I don't think she's quite there yet. It's going to probably be a while before she does that. But I think the way they portrayed that was really well. Like, they had this moment where her master comes and visit her. Because she can run really fast. Her master comes and visit her. And immediately when she gets there, she's like, oh, I was expecting you to be in a corner crying. And I would sweep you up. And I would take you with me back home. And she's like, no, I'm perfectly fine. Then the moment she leaves, Sarasa starts crying in the corner because she's alone. It pulls off that kind of aspect really well. The cool thing that I really wasn't expecting as it went on was that element of how well they portrayed I guess, what her resources are. The whole idea of an alchemist, obviously, is that the alchemist or somebody, a gatherer, will go out, gain resources, you know, herbs, tooths, nails of beasts, whatever, brings them back. They then take that and they synthesize it in a pot and they create a potion or something. But obviously there are some things that take more resources or objects that are more rare. And at some point they have, out of nowhere, they barge into her place with this girl that's missing her entire arm. And they said, save her life. And she immediately goes to, it's going to be expensive. Will you cover it? And then immediately everybody gets these couple of guys that are in the room get angry. Like, how could you put a value on life? And she's like, she's being truthful about it. And they kind of have to shuffle the guys out of the room to let her do what she's doing. And immediately, her friend immediately goes, yes, do it. I'll pay whatever it takes. Because it was an aspect of, I can either save her life or I can restore her back to 100%, which is, yes, includes restoring her arms. And the reason why she was pointing that out is because, yes, these materials cost money and they're finite. I can't just produce unlimited amounts of potions that will save every life. And it was kind of more, and they get more into it later, pushing heavy on the idea that if I waste all these resources to restore her to 100%, that means that's one less potion, one less bottle that I have for the next life. And that's kind of a point that she was really kind of instilling upon them that they weren't really understanding at the point, because she was bringing it up while somebody was possibly going to die. And I like that it hit on that, and yes, technically later on, hitting on, well, would you do it anyways? And she's like, yeah, I probably would, but I was just hoping that it would actually cover the cost, because again, everything costs money. And it was cool that one of the other guys kind of points out the idea of, well, you do realize every potion she used was a risk somebody took to get a material. Because every single one of those things has materials in it that a gatherer has to go out and risk their lives to get to bring back. You can't just willy-nilly just pour all this stuff out, which is literally what she had to do to restore this girl to 100%. She was like bottles all over the floor that she had to go through just to fully restore her. And again, I wasn't really expecting that amount of effort and effort being put into her craft and what it's required and the risks and the rewards of everything that she does. And the way that they kind of pulled all that stuff was really fantastic. The only thing that I have not liked about the show, my big negative that has me sort of afraid for going forward, the recent episode, which I think was episode 4, the bear attack. Hate it. That was kind of the worst episode of the entire thing, and I really hope that's not what they have in store going forward. Because it's like, starting out, it's like, yes, her horrible life, opening the shop, insecurities, the village, being accepted in the village, saving a life, the cost of a life. And then overpowered main character takes down a bunch of bears. Please don't like, it came out of nowhere suddenly. Oh yeah, by the way, she's also like super OP and she's just running around killing everything. Okay, apparently that's taught in alchemy school. Don't know. They could have sort of implied that it was Ophelia that taught her that, but still, it was like that's not what I want. I hope that that's not what they do. Yes, I kind of agree with Chris. I do like that idea of her going out with her friends and them, her throwing bottles on monsters and it, you know, taking them out or whatever. That would be fun just to get the materials to bring back, which is, again, similar to the Atelier games. But I don't want super OP enhanced running around slicing things in half left and right. It was like easily the most boring and useless episode of the entire thing. It was just, so let's see how OP she is. She saved everybody. Yay. I guess my hope is to go back to all the other stuff, which is really, you know, gaining friends, allies, shop, all that kind of stuff, building it up. And yes, technically the thing they brought up at the very beginning, which is the alchemy works. It would be really cool to see how they can kind of interplay the alchemy works as kind of an achievement. The alchemy works is basically achievement list, and she has to go through each of the books, and it gets harder and harder as it goes along. And they kind of went out of their way to point out her asking her master, have you completed all 10? She's like, no, only crazy people do that. At some point, like a 9 or something like that, it just turns into artifacts that are kind of too much effort for their own gain. But there's a lot of cool stuff behind that. Like, technically, I would assume that the bag, the endless bag that she has that has lowered weights, is technically one of those things that she probably built. And it kind of gets in that whole thing that we talked about with the alchemy games, is like that aspect of creating something, but then there's like another attribute to it that benefits it more, like lowering weight or whatever. I think it would be really cool, like having people come in with an issue and then she creates something to solve it by getting extra attributes added to it that benefit them in some way. While again, friendships, village, trust and all that kind of stuff building alongside of it. So
the episode that came out today, it was kind of going back to the idea of the building, going from place to place and doing things involved with, you know, trading and stuff.
I like how she goes and like, she just gets the place that they bought and it's like, it's run down. But then she's like looking around, she's looking for a cleaning gym. Like there's like these gyms that can like embed into the wall, which if you put mana into it, it keeps the house clean. And she finds it and she uses it and it cleans the room. And then she goes to another room and then she dusts it out. I'm like, what? She just used a cleaning gem. Why does she have to use air wind magic over here? Unless it's that floor only and that was above her or something. I don't know. But it didn't even touch the outside. Like, the outside still looks terrible. But no, it was kind of funny. But yeah.
So it's I can say that the next episode is getting back to what they were doing before. They didn't go to the... Hopefully they'll stay away from the killing stuff. So not that I necessarily have a problem with it, but because it'd be interesting to see them partying and
like battle party, not them party woohoo.
Not necessarily make her, because I agree with Andrew. I mean, that was kind of the most boring part of it, was her, even though it was interesting to see how they did the kind of the keyhole
that was so useless. Don't give me... I thought too. I was like, okay, cool, she's got this. Okay, everybody have a plan if you listen to us. And everybody's like, well, heck yeah. All right, tell us what to do. And so it's like, okay, we're going to make this whole, like, fencing system that's going to corral them like cows. Like, it was literally cattle. Mm-hmm. Like, they were trying to cattle these dragons, and they were – or dragons. These bear – flame bears. And they were using these, like, embers that the bears were coming after that they were short on that's making them, you know, travel around. And it's, like, this – to lure it down this little cattle corral. And then, like, within a second, they just suddenly turn and start busting through the fence. It's like, what was the point of the stupid corral? The moment the ladies came out there and started banging pans, they immediately broke out of it. And then she had to do OP, rush around, and slice everything up. It almost felt like you built up this whole preparation. And in the end, the result was Sarasa OP flies around and slices everything in half. Again, that was kind of the... Anyway, I'm getting back into it. I love the show. I'm very... pleasantly surprised by how much I'm enjoying the show. It's been probably, I mean, besides The Raven and the Inner Palace and Bibliophile Princess, which are absolutely phenomenal, this one is the other one that's kind of like, I didn't have any expectations for this. I felt it was going to be a throwaway show of the season, and I'm really, really enjoying it. Besides that one episode, it has been really fantastic, and I love the characters. I love how it's kind of building everything, and it's been a lot more emotional and interesting than I thought it was going to be. So, yeah, there you go. That's Management of a Novice Alchemist. It was cool. There's another cool aspect that they have of the series, which is at the end of each episode, it has a tally of what she spends.
Yeah.
And it was cool because to give you an idea, like a baseline, in the first episode, she buys these 10 alchemy works, which apparently is very expensive. Normally, it's like 25 million currency. And thankfully, since she was able to buy it through her master said, if you pass your exam, I will sell it to you for $5 million. So she worked her entire school life to build up $5 million yen. That's how expensive that is. And so she's got it. She doesn't have to worry about it ever again. That's literally your encyclopedia. If this is your job, you have to have these books. It's a necessity. Typically, people buy like one or two volumes at a time. She bought the whole set. To give you an idea there, later on, like I said earlier with the whole value of life thing, the efforts to make this one girl 100% again, restore her arm and restore her to life, that cost $20 million. So pretty much the cost of that book series, which is what all alchemists have to have, which took her entire school life to build up, four times as much to restore that girl. That was the value of life she was talking about. I'm going to have to spend 20 million currency of resources to restore her life. And that would have taken her four times of years of college working to put together. That's how expensive that was. Anyways, yeah, cool stuff. The exam I totally forgot to talk about. I love the exam where she's like overthinking it. I was kind of curious how they were going to work that out. It was this idea they lay out fantastic with that. They lay out resources, and the student has to make a potion. So they have to choose all the stuff. But then she sees one material and goes, oh, my master keeps telling me, and she's beating into my head, do not mistake this material for this other material. You're not going to make what you're making. And she sees that. And so she's like, oh, crap, what do I do? I wonder if they want me to make a high potion. So she goes through the process of pouring a large amount of mana, which should not be possible for a person their age and her level, because she's special, pours all this mana and these resources into a pot and makes a high potion. They're like, kind of shocked, like, wow, why did she go through the effort of making a high potion? That's great. That's fine. But she didn't have to do that. Oh, they got the materials wrong. Don't tell anybody, though. Like, we can't ruin the reputation of the university. Just pass her and get her out the door. Don't say anything about this. So it was like, do we bring in the ones that failed? No. It's like, gosh, that's kind of mean. It was cool, though. I liked it. So anyways, there you go. Management of a Novus Alchemist. And our last one for this episode is Shinomi no Itoki, or Itoki the Ninja, which is streaming on Crunchyroll, running for 12 episodes, done by Troika, is an original, and that's basically all the information I have for who's working on it, because I don't think there was anything special behind the people that were working on this one. But essentially, it opens up following a guy named Itoki, and Itoki is your usual modern-day student in Japan going to school. It seems like it's quickly kind of establishing that his entire schedule is swamped with different classes and stuff that he does on the side, gymnastics and all this other kind of stuff. His mom just kind of has filled his schedule. He just isn't really able to have a normal child life of socializing and having fun with his friends because he just got a bunch of school and stuff that he does. Well, at some point, he ends up having a love letter from this one girl named Satomi. And so he goes and meets her at school, and she immediately says, I've watched you at the festival. You brought everybody together. You're so cool. I really like you. Please go out with me. And so he's like, all right, cool. Let's do that. He goes back home, and he's super excited, and his mom kind of quickly notes that he's chippery. So obviously he met somebody. And he says, yeah, I know this girl, Satomi. She confessed to me, and she's like, oh, so she's somebody from your class. And he's like, No, I don't know anything about her. She's from another class. And immediately his mom says, no, I'm not going to allow it. Don't do it. Sure enough, he goes out to date with her anyways, and she takes him back to her place and then immediately jumps on him, take off her clothes, and says that she wants to make out with him. And he's like, whoa, what main character? I can't touch this stuff. And then sure enough, he thinks that it's a hidden camera show. So he immediately looks under the bed to look for the guy that's going to pop out with the camera, and it's a ninja. He literally tries to kill him. So, yeah, and a bunch of people pop out, and this girl, Kosetsu, who always follows Itoki around, who's a childhood friend, jumps in there, quickly attacking them. They whisk him off. Tons of chase scenes and ninjas popping out of nowhere, attacking, and eventually, yes, he finds out that, oh, by the way, you are the next in line of the Iga clan. By the way, your mom's the current clan leader. She was kind of, the position was forced upon her after your father died, and she's been taking care of things and trying to hide it from you so that you can enjoy your life. But now that the secret's out, this Koga clan is trying to kill you because they believe that the Iga clan killed their leader. So they want to kill the next in line, which is you. So time to shape up and become a ninja and head the clan. And then that jumps to school days. Because ninja school. Your thoughts?
It's school. It's not school days. It's
not ninja. That school days. Not that school days.
Right now, they just got to school. He went to go get a manju bun from somebody, and then the kids wanted to bully him because he's obviously Iga clan and Koga clan don't like him. So, girls. They added Aoyuki.
Yeah.
So
eventually she'll probably be a psychopath that wants to kill him, but
I'm sure she'll get crazy at some point. that's the gist of the show. I mean, it's one of those that it's meandering. I want to see that they're going to pull something together, but as it stands right now, I mean, the character moments that they've tried to put in here, or the drama beats, have been kind of meh.
The only drama beat was probably the fact that the father died, the mother had to take over.
Yeah.
She kept it a secret from him, and she literally said, if you want, through somebody else, she literally said, Itoki, if you want to run away, do it. But it would be nice if you took over.
That's my point, is they're trying to imply this great weight on him, but when it comes down to it, I mean, I guess I could see the weight, but when it comes down to it, I don't really care. I don't care this that much about these characters yet because the kid is barely interesting. None of the other characters are that much interesting. I guess when we get to know them, if we can get to know them, because they're all ninjas. So they're going to put off this one face that is technically not their real face. So
how do you develop characters when everybody is a ninja and they don't want to reveal their secrets?
Exactly. So, I mean, I guess we'll get to know everybody and then at some point, I guess maybe it'll get interesting. So I hope. Right now I'm less than lukewarm about it. I'll see if I get interested at some point, but as it stands right now, it's kind of cool.
I think that's the sad thing about it is that Troika's finally doing something besides Idolish 7. I love Troika because I'll know Zero and Recreators and stuff, but this is not what I wanted. It just feels like fantasy fulfillment ninja. Like, oh, all kids want to be a ninja. Well, now Itoki's a ninja, and he doesn't want to be a ninja. That's like the whole crux of it is, wouldn't it be cool to be self-insert main character ninja, and you get to join the ninja clan and learn ninja stuff, and then cute girls show up, and then they're actually ninjas, and they want to kill you? I don't know. So far, it's not really done anything for me. I think the biggest issue that I have is I wouldn't mind it being very simple, wish fulfillment, become a modern-day ninja. It's cool stuff. Like, I like ninja stuff. I like the idea of modern ninja, especially the idea of technology blending in with ninjas is really cool. They have the whole thing they got in with the recent episode was the ninja suits themselves, which are all like tailor made for the ninja. The more tailor made it is, the better it works, and it's all about like enhancement of the body structure being this like plug suit basically, and the core is in the wrist, which I think is a really bad design flaw that if you bump this core on the wrist, your suit breaks. Probably should put that somewhere else. But still, that's the concept. It's kind of cool, and that kind of plays into I think the what it seemed like the core story they're really going for here is somebody from the outside that literally had no clue it existed, now having to be the head of one of the clans, and yet there being this feud between clans that shouldn't be. And it feels like he's kind of similar to what I was saying with Gundam Mercury, being the one that possibly can bridge the clans together by realizing that they're all human basically. But I think the big problem they're having from the very beginning is that, like we joke about, they don't communicate. So they're sending Itoki off to this training academy that's headed by so you have the clans. And the clans were always at war with each other for long generations. And then at some point, they kind of said stop. Like some point, society, the clans themselves decided, let's stop killing each other. And so they created this other corporation that essentially monitors all the clans. And basically says if you were to kill this other ninja from this other clan, they would, you know, pass down judgment. So they're almost like this governance system over all the clans. And so what they're establishing from the very beginning is that the Iga clan, they're claiming the Iga clan killed the leader of the Koga clan. It's obvious this guy that's currently running the Koga clan killed the dude. If that doesn't end up being the case, I'll be super shocked. But yeah, Kendro Suda killed the current leader of Koga and blamed it on the Iga. So now the Koga clan hates Iga and wants to kill him. So the fact that now we're finally revealing this to Itoki, which should have been revealed a long time ago, honestly. Now they're revealing this, they're still keeping secrets from him, and so he's now having to learn from the Koga clan people why they hate him so much. Why was that not told to him? Doesn't make sense to me.
and then they even go to do a cut scene where they show his uncle talking to his mom and like, so you don't think it would be a good idea to tell him about all this stuff?
Right.
No, he needs to find out on his own.
Why? His life is at stake. That doesn't even... And now, the consistency from there, it's been throughout the... That's my big problem with this entire series. I hate the logic breaking they keep doing. That aspect, not being clear with him. At the same time, they're sending him to an... Okay, so the Koga clan tried to kill Itoki in the first episode. They tried to kill him. So the governing system... Yes, walked into the Koga clan and said, we have evidence that you tried to kill somebody from the Iga clan. And they went, oh, yeah, that was a rogue person. Definitely not a part of our group. Yeah, we were trying to look for them for a long time. They basically covered it up, and they accepted it. Now you're going to trust Itoki to go to an academy run by that organization, which has Koga Clan people in it, and you're saying that's his safest place to be. No! The safest place to be is in hiding with you, training how to become a ninja. Why would you send him to an organization that has Koga people all around him that are going to be wanting to kill him? It doesn't make any sense. Adding that, like, the stupidest one was in the first episode. He's fleeing from the Koga Clan. He just nearly got killed by this chick. They throw him out the window. Somehow this room that they were in, this bedroom, suddenly became like five times as huge because Kosetsu immediately grabs Itoki in this bedroom. There's gas everywhere. She grabs Itoki, chucks him into the air, kicks like five people. 5 seconds later, he comes back down. She grabs him, chucks him out the window. Where'd she throw him? That's probably like that room's probably like 8 feet at the most. But anyways, after he leaves, they get him in the car. They go in this car chase. The car eventually, you know, slams to the railing. They shoot him out and say, go to the nearest town. Run. We'll handle this. He runs to the nearest town. As he's walking into the town, this police officer bikes up and he goes, what's wrong? And Itoki's like, man, all this crazy stuff happening. And suddenly this ninja appears behind the cop, slits the guy's throat. The cop falls on the ground dying. And then they surround him. Can you guess what they do next? They don't kill him. No, because the Koga Clan's not trying to kill him. They gag him, tie him up, and start kicking him on the ground. They don't kill him. They had a chance to kill him. Then his bodyguard, Kaga guy, shows up to save Itoki. And he's got his cool suit. He's a cool ninja. He's coming in to save Itoki. Immediately he goes, yeah, you can get up off the ground. I know you're faking it. The cop stands up. The cop stands up. They were faking it out the whole time. The cop was actually a part of the Koga Clan, and he was in disguise. Why did you bother fake killing the cop when he's a part of the group? And why didn't you just kill Itoki like you were planning on killing him?
Stop, Andrew. No logic. Logic is not allowed. It seems more cool because they're ninjas.
Again, and then the ninja suits being their core is on the wrist, and if you break the core, your suit fails. Anyways. Oh, yeah, and then guys going around beating up people before the mochi because they don't want to climb up to get the mochi themselves.
Andrew! Aoyuki's in this.
But yeah, he got to save Aoyuki because of that. Oh, and then having to do hide and seek inside of a marketplace. Anyways, it visually looks okay. I mean, it's not like fantastic, but visually it looks the CGI card is kind of rough, but it visually looks okay. We'll see. I'm still going to watch it because Choika, but and Aoyuki technically, but hopefully more cute girls don't get blamed for assassinations and gassed in their prisons because that happened. There you go. Shinobi no Itoki. Check that out. That's interesting. That's all we're going to cover. Let's end it on a funny note because that show is special. But yeah, that's it. That's all we're going to cover for now. Again, we'll come back next week for, 12 more of them. There's plenty of shows to go through, but I hope you guys enjoy this particular podcast episode for the fall 2022 anime season. Again, all of our links at our otakuspirit.com. You can go there for our links to our Patreon, our Discord, our tips link. Everything is there. Definitely appreciate everybody's support and for everybody that's going into our growing community of Discord. I did realize after people told me, I think twice now and I keep screwing it up, I have been accidentally placing a temporary link, which I thought it was fixed last time, but apparently wasn't, a temporary link to the Discord. So if you've been trying to get into our Discord and it keeps saying it's expired, it should be fixed now. If you go to otakuspirit.com or it's on my Twitter feed too, otakuspirit, at otakuspirit did. But, yeah, if you've been having troubles, get in. Try it now. I apologize. That's probably why we've been not seeing many new people joining lately. Probably because of that. I apologize. You could have yelled at me. Somebody did yell at me. But yeah, that's fixed now, so you can check that out. But yeah, I'll see if we can get a link to the Spotify music list too. I forgot to do that last time. I think I said we were going to do that last time. But yeah, for some reason, I keep searching for a Talky Spirit picks and I don't see it. But the link is in the Discord. If you go in there, we post the link in there. So anyways, Hope you guys enjoyed this episode. As always, we thank you for your support and letting other people know about us. And y'all take care.
Oos.